Tonight's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by Slasher Crasher, the debut horror comedy novel of David Nora. It was the night he tried to go home, but he got caught in their drama. It's Halloween. Nick Roche, a towering figure of evil and stupidity, escapes from upstate New York's mental hospital, where he's been committed for the past 5 years. Planning to return to his childhood home, where he murdered his babysitter's boyfriend, his plans are halted when he crosses paths with an even more terrifying beast. Two high school friends with some serious beef. Caught up in a battle of loyalty that has been brewing for 10 years of their friendship, the two girls, Kathleen Strife and Betsy Coleman, force the feud into a savage showdown, pitting the escaped monster against each other. Who will survive this epic death match? And is it totally wrong to fall in love with the murderous lunatic who just tried to kill your best friend with a machete? It's available on Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, and at BlackRoseWriting.com. For more information, you can find David Nora on Twitter and Instagram at David Nora Jr.
Okay, welcome to episode 167 of Shockwaves. The whole gang is back.
We're here!
I'm here in ghost form.
What? Oh my God.
I'm a ghost.
Rob Galuzzo here. Elric Kane is with us. Yep. How you doing, man? You okay?
Yeah, we haven't been in a room for a few weeks.
You guys did Eggers.
Yes, and then, it was just an Elric.
And that was like 2 weeks ago.
Yep.
That was a fun.
That was a lot
slightly
of fun.
Slightly awkward chat.
It was so smooth, easy. That's like playing
so
tennis
easy
with a
to
pro.
Connect, yeah.
But it was interesting. I will say that. Like, you got some really good stuff out of that.
That's true.
I think that was one that maybe played better.
We finally got behind the mystery of the Vitch.
Yes.
The Vitch.
The Vitch.
That became news. Well done.
And unfortunately, we got Nosferatu canceled. So
we talked about
so
it.
So you guys are to blame for there being no Nosferatu.
Ryan Turek is back.
Hello.
Where'd you go?
You guys look great.
Where'd you go?
Where have you been? We've been waiting for you, Ryan.
I was in the woods of Haddonfield walking around.
Oh. Yeah. How'd that
doing
go?
Doing some soul searching.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah, it was great.
Cool.
Did you find a soul?
I did. Okay. I did. Many. We killed many.
What was your favorite part that you can tell us? Not of the movie, but of the experience.
Because
you've never done this, right? The entire shoot? You've never been on set for the entire, like, three months?
No, I have.
He was there for the entire shoot last time, right?
It was an abridged version of the pre-production. Like, yeah. I came in, like, a couple weeks before we started shooting.
Okay.
But, yeah, this one is the one where we, like, hard prep. I was there on the day. Yeah.
Well, I'm seeing some new ink here. Demon's Mask. What's the other one? That happened
out there.
Well, you know, I met this fantastic tattoo artist.
I got the earrings on right now, too.
Yeah. He from Cape Fear Tattoo, and he reached out to me and he was like, "Hey man, I'm a big fan of Shockwaves.
Hey.
Love to tattoo wow. you." And I said, "That's a great idea."
And now, because, how many did you go?
I got three.
I see three. I'm literally three. Looking, and he's got well, half a sleeve going
this
on here.
This chopping mall tattoo.
I can't even believe I doodled while I
was doing an episode like months ago. And he was amazing because I sent him my doodle and I said, "Look, I did this while I was listening to these goobers on Shockwaves." And he was like, and then he sent me back this art. And I was like, "That's exactly what I wanted."
The fact that it says, "Have a nice day." Uh-huh. What's on the inside?
The inside is nice. My ode to Splatterhouse.
Oh, nice.
That one looks great. Yeah.
I want you to get the giant tongue he fights in level one right there.
That's a great idea.
Just the giant tongue. And, this like it's one licking is, your armpit.
And then this one was an unexpected one. It was Baba's Demons.
Yeah. Well, unexpected? What, you sat down and the guy
no,
just
because, no, because
after 8 hours, I was like, wow, how did that get there?
No, because we were talking. He was amazing because you walked into his area, the tattoo shop, and it was just all horror. NECA toys, posters. Nice. He had a flat screen TV up on the wall. And we watched movies while he was tattooing.
Oh, cool.
And he was great. We went through Razorback. We went through Elvira, Mistress of the Dark. We did the Burbs.
So on your back is a giant pig.
Yeah,
you got a boar on your back.
I want all the lyrics to the Elvira, Mistress of the Dark rap, which I can still do in completion. I want it on your back.
It's right so there. Good. It's so good. But he was like,
"So is he listening? This guy's listening."
He is probably. Yeah. But he was like, "What would you get next?" And I was like, "Well, I would really love to get a stage fright." And he's like, "I can come up with a cool owl and axe thing,
man."
And then And then I switched gears and I was like, oh man, the Demon's Mask is so awesome. I was like, Demon's Mask. And then within the next day, he was like, I got this for you. And the funny thing is, if you're listening, Rick, he was like, he said to me, he's like, well, I did have a cool idea for the stage fright thing. And then when I landed back home, I was sifting through his Instagram stories and I saw the design.
Oh.
And he was like, up for grabs. And I was like,
oh no.
Oh, it was so cool. He did one Maximum Overdrive, one after I left.
Of course. Oh my gosh. The jester.
The Green Goblin. Yeah. But that's beyond the point. Halloween's great. It lives up to its title. It's cool.
Awesome.
I'll just say that there was one particular day where at the end of the evening, I was tracking blood into my hotel room.
So, that's great.
Because it was still stuck to my boot and just kind of dripping off my boot.
Did you guys use Easy Clean?
I don't know what we used, but it was fun. Wow. Definitely.
So it wasn't PG-13 blood.
It's definitely not. PG-13. You know,
while we were in Knoxville, I tried to convince both of these guys to come with me to get a tattoo. I was like, let's just get something small to commemorate the travels.
No.
And they wouldn't.
You get Elric's face. Rob gets Becca's.
I want Elric's face on my face so when he looks at me across the table, he sees himself.
Yeah. And we all get Ernie's.
Deep.
we all get Ernie on our back.
I wouldn't mind a Shockwave tattoo. I do like
that. I would do a Shockwave tattoo.
We know one person with a Shockwave tattoo,
yes,
right? We have
sure.
one
yeah.
listener.
For sure. Yeah.
I would totally do a Shockwave tattoo, guys.
So and by the way, last but not least, Rebecca McKenna.
Oh, hey, guys. I'm here too.
Yeah. And Ernie's recording us.
My voice isn't that bad.
Actually, it's not pretty good now.
It's not that horrible.
She was cracking the other day with that.
Yeah, one of my kids gave me something stupid last week, but I'm good now.
We've heard all your home. Kids.
Yeah.
Which sums up my Disney Plus experience.
Oh, I'm
so
having
far.
A great time. I saw your post.
Oh, my God.
Like, I'm watching whatever I want.
All right.
But wait a second. What was the first thing you added to your queue?
Mr. Boogity.
Mine was the Cat from Outer Space.
Oh, wow. Nice.
Oh, and Black Hole, which I can't wait to revisit.
Black Hole is amazing. Yeah.
And of course, they've got the National Treasure movies. So
yeah, it's very overwhelming.
What I did see an article. What don't they have? Is it just the kind of racist and stuff they want to bury?
Well, according to
Song of the South stuff,
that stuff's on there apparently.
No,
not
Song of the South.
Not Song of the South.
There's no way they're going
to. No. But you don't need to reach for Song of the South to find their weird racist shit. It's pervasive through a lot of the early
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, obviously the early.
There was an article. I forgot where it was today. Wired or somewhere, there was an article that was like, here's the racist stuff you'll find on Disney Plus.
I'm sure
now.
Peter Pan's on there, and I mean, that thing's racist as fuck.
It's got warnings in the.
Oh, does it really?
Yeah. They all have warnings.
Well, where
now.
Was the warning for the fucking Star Wars retooling that they did?
Which apparently, they redid something in Star Wars again, but apparently Lucas did that before he turned it into them. So it's the ultimate troll.
He is really.
Oh my God, that is so Lucas-y of him.
Vanity Fair said that 7 years ago he made that change before he turned it.
Yeah, apparently. Now Han and Greedo shoot at the same time.
No. Well,
That's what I read.
On the kids' side, my daughter. So far, we've watched Halloween Town 1 and 2, which is great because that's one of the characters. When I was picking the name Marnie, that I was like, "This is a good name," because the lead female in Halloween Town is named Marnie. And then we also watched Hocus Pocus again, which is on there. Descendants 3 is not. So only 1 and 2.
Why would anything not be on?
I don't know.
Certain things are still licensed out to other digital platforms.
Mm-hmm. Wreck-It
Ralph.
Usually
those deals are like 4 or 5 years, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. So there actually is a few titles that you'll click on, and it says this will not be available until January 2020.
Yeah, we couldn't find Wreck-It Ralph on there, but there was everything else.
But the sequel, or one of them is on
there. Yeah, one of them is on there, and one of them is not. Mm-hmm. But okay. Toy Story 3 is.
But would Caravan of Courage be on there and stuff like that?
I don't know, maybe.
It's a shit ton of the old stuff.
It is literally so overwhelming, like that. You know, because there's different tabs for Disney. Like, I went to Marvel and they have every freaking Marvel cartoon ever, including the 70s Spider-Woman cartoon.
Oh, I like that one.
Well, sure.
Disney does as well, because I watched Gargoyles at the gym yesterday, and how crazy cool is that? It was just a fun show.
I'm
going to
wait till the kids leave for college before I get it. Yep. So I've got a path. I've got a plan. I've got to wait another 10 years.
I did 10 minutes of Mandalorian and was like, this is so amazing. And then immediately I got Mommy put on Mickey and the Roadster Racers, and thus ends my Mandalorian.
Kids, the parents need to watch Star Wars.
Star Wars, guys.
I didn't see
Star Wars.
I watched today the directorial debut of Mick Garris, Fuzzbucket.
Fuzzbucket is a trip.
That's
good. Elric's mind is blowing. He's like, Fuzzbucket.
Yeah. I had never heard of
first thing. First thing he wrote, directed, and I think John Landis exec produced it.
Huh. It's in the vein of E.T. and Mac and Me. There was a whole bunch of little monster kid movies that came out right around that time, and Fuzzbucket was one of them. Mm.
Yeah.
But yes. Horror.
But horror.
But horror. Horror.
We got stuff to talk about.
So we want much. That Disney sponsorship. Come on. Push it. Actually, the first question, I don't know if we ever heard. What'd you do on Halloween down there? Like, I don't know what you did on Halloween.
Oh, Halloween.
Were you
night,
down October there on 31st?
Halloween? Yeah. Oh, we were shooting.
So that's the whole set? You guys okay. didn't get all right, a special
right, wait. All right, so I got a fun story because our friends, Joshua John Miller, Mark Fortin, Joshua John Miller, who did Final Girls, wrote Final Girl script. They are now doing a film on the same lot that we were shooting Halloween. This lot is the Screen Gems lot, and it was created by Dino De Laurentiis when he was doing movies like Firestarter and Silver Bullet and all that stuff. Yeah. And on Halloween Day, we all, because this is out there and was, you know, kind of on the internet, but I created the code name Mob Rules for a very specific reason. We all come up with code names. You have to come up with code names for every production. So I came up with Mob Rules, and the art department decided to create a font that was very similar to 101 Dalmatians. So I go down there, and I'm like, let me see this cool Mob Rules logo that you created, because I'm thinking like the Black Sabbath album. And I see this Dalmatians thing, and I was like, what the fuck, guys? And on top of it, they put David Green's Mob Rules, and they did it in the Disney font. So the 101 Dalmatians thing became a joke. So on Halloween Day, our wardrobe department was like, everybody should dress like Dalmatians. And aww. So they handed out black spots to people who were just going to wear white, and some people dressed up like a Dalmatian. And because I don't wear white, I wore all black, and they gave me white spots.
Nice.
So I put white spots all over my body, and while I'm there, I get a text from Josh Miller, and he's like, hey, do you have a mask? And I was like, it wasn't a Halloween mask. I had another kind of mask. And he was like, I just need something for Halloween. I was like, sure. He was like, come into the office and hand it over. And I was like, where are you? He's like, well, I'm rehearsing with Russell Crowe.
Ah.
And Russell Crowe is in the movie. And I was like, okay, sure. And I walk in, and there's fucking Russell Crowe.
Yeah.
And I'm dressed like a dumbass. And I have this like clown mask in my hand. And I'm like, hey, Josh, here. Hey, how's it going? Happy Halloween. Mark, hey, good to see you. Big hugs. And then I look over and they're like, this is Russell. And I was like, oh, hey, Russell Crowe. And he just gives me this look and he smiles and he goes, nice to meet you, man.
Nice.
So thanks. And I walked out just like head hanging low. And I was like, God damn it. Not the time to meet Russell Crowe.
No, that is the...
But it was really – that's what we did. We were shooting – we were actually doing splits that night. So we were shooting well into the night and it was fun.
I like the idea though that there's a Halloween movie that has now been made and shot.
During
being
Halloween.
Shot on Halloween night.
Yes.
I like that.
Yes.
You'll have to point out to us when it comes out what scene was being shot on Halloween night.
I remember that. Okay. I do remember that.
So
we'll
wait for that in the commentary.
Yeah. And that was actually a specially graphic night, which was fun.
I love it. Super fun.
Yeah. During the weekends, I caught up on movies and TV and all that kind of fun stuff. So
what was everyone else's Halloween?
I can't even remember.
You guys haven't done an episode since
like
then?
A couple hours of trick or treat.
Yeah, we had. That was just a week ago. As weird as that is, that was literally a week ago.
It feels like a year ago.
I know. Yeah, like last year when we had Halloween. I adopted a dog on Halloween Day.
Oh, that's right.
That was pretty cool. Cute. So,
I know. That dog is a
Poe. Yeah, she's got big bat ears. Yeah, so, but she reminds me of, I almost named her Lenore, but that's the name of David Scow's cat. And
a dead woman, right? Lenore is always dead, so.
It's like Edgar Allan Poe, like always his wrote ex, about her, Lenore. Yeah. So yeah, but we ended up going with Poe.
So trick-or-treating, basically. I never do much of like events on that.
Yeah,
I mean,
you have good costumes, though, because you went to trivia dressed as Coffin Joe.
That was actually fun.
That was really good.
Fun last minute, like, oh, what could I do? And when I had that, I had to get super fun. I'll tell you what I was going to try to do, and I just couldn't pull it off. I wanted to do Joe Spinell and Maniac. I just realized I have no idea how to do that effectively. Like the hair, the sweat, the weight, the mustache.
The wig,
so one day I will work towards the Joe Spinell.
You should do the bluish winter hat kind of in the coat.
Oh, Yeah, exactly.
That's like a recognizable motif, like but still.
One day I'll get there.
I did Suspiria, which
was
a total trip to make.
The newer one.
I did like that red braided thing. Gosh.
As in, it's a trip because she kept tripping.
Literally.
So like, what I didn't even think about is when we do trivia is it's this room full of chairs and I'm constantly walking through this room full of chairs and every single time I would walk through, my costume would get stuck on something and part of it would rip off and halfway through the night I was just like,
fuck this.
She's wearing sweats and a sweater.
And I put a sweatshirt.
shirt on, and I was like, I'm done. I'm just done. Like, none of my costume's going to be left by the time I leave
but
here.
But it did look good. That was a good costume.
Thank you.
They were very recognizable, which is good. Yeah.
Both your costumes.
I had the most deep cut one. Alyssa was in town for Halloween, and she really wanted to be the married couple from One Country Dead.
And I
looked at a photo of them, and I'm like, we could pull this off.
Mm-hmm. I mean, she looks like literally like she could have been in that movie.
Yours
is just what they
do. What? I said, what are you saying?
No, but I mean, his one, you had to go, oh, yeah, yeah. If next to a picture, Rob sells it.
Yes, no, but she did. Yes. She had the exact, like, the jean vest and the yellow headband.
Yeah,
like,
I couldn't believe how perfectly she found that whole outfit.
That was good.
That was fun. And she got to trick-or-treat for the first time ever because she's never celebrated Halloween.
Nice. Oh, my gosh. Where'd you guys go trick-or-treating?
South Pasadena.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. It was fun. Scott Reynolds, friend of the show and all. He's got an incredible Immortal Masks Frankenstein that looks very realistic. So we were basically walking through South Pasadena. He was scaring the shit out of little kids that were looking at him in this mask. But it was very sweet. He would walk Alyssa up to houses and literally say,
aww,
she's from France. This is her first time trick-or-treating. And he'd be like, oh, my God, come over here.
Oh, that's great.
So
that's
wonderful.
They're very sweet to her.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. That's so
it was great. Great time. Yeah. Oh, and then we watched, because normally everyone does the original Halloween or trick-or-treat or whatever. We did a backyard screening of The Guest, which actually was kind of
a
fun
Halloween movie.
Yeah, I was like, oh, yeah, this kind of works now. It's been a few years. Yeah. One of my friends is like, oh, you could tell this is post-Drive.
Oh, big time.
They're like, oh, this is the post-Drive era where it's all colorful, the electronic
A lot of pink in that lighting.
You know, good-looking white dude that might be a little crazy, you know, whole thing. So, yeah, The Guest is a fun Halloween movie.
Yeah.
Nice to mix it up.
So I assume you guys saw a ton, because I did, because it's been 2 weeks.
I don't know if we need to go beyond a Doctor Sleep, because to me that was – did everyone see it?
Yeah. No.
What?
We were going
to
go.
We were supposed to go.
And she got sick.
And I got sick.
This is amazing.
And here I was, because all weekend long I was watching social media and a lot of amazing writers and friends who were talking about, you know, going out and supporting the film. But it always began with horror fans, where are you? And I was like, the horror fans are already out there. It's everybody else that needs to see it.
Yes.
And here I am sitting with two people.
We were supposed to go on Sunday night, and I got sick. And
it'll definitely be seen before the next week.
It will be seen.
But the question is it as – do you think it's as simple as like it came out a week after Halloween, or do you think there's more to it in terms of financial?
My students and granted, you know, I don't want to put it all on the 20-somethings, but a lot of them were like, it's a sequel to a 40-year-old movie that I've seen a couple times. This is my general student populace, not my horror class. Like, my horror class, every single one went to see it, and I've had to shush them from talking about it with me. But my general students were just kind of like, I don't know, I think I may have seen it once. Why did they make a sequel now? And so it's something, it's just not hitting.
There was a disconnect, because I know after I saw it, and I posted vague things, like the photo of Ewan McGregor looking through the thing, and I literally had three people that I know in life say, what is that? And I'm like, it's Dr. Sleep. And they're like, yeah, but why is it? I'm like, it's the sequel to The Shining. And they're like, oh, I had no idea. I'm going to go see it now.
Maybe that's what your job is here tonight.
People don't realize, even though the trailers and everything give it away.
It's crystal clear in the trailer.
This is marketing.
Do you think a week? Because I do think they're saying to the, like, I can just say for us.
It should have come out in October.
Yeah, I do get a little burned out and almost want to take a couple weeks off usually at the end of October.
Yeah, I mean, possibly. I mean, like, there was nothing else that was, there was nothing else that was coming out in October. Did I call in?
You called in one time.
I called in. Did I see Countdown? Have we talked about that?
Countdown.
Yeah, I went to go see Countdown, which was released by STX.
That was in theaters?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't even know that one.
Yeah, that was the lead actress from the TV show You is the lead of that. But anyways, that was the only competition that they would actually have if it was competition. But I mean, Rob, you and I echo the same sentiment. I think the movie is amazing. I absolutely, absolutely loved
it.
There are moments where
is there a way I can listen without being crazy?
Yeah. Well, I think – I mean, look, you should know – vibe-wise what you're getting if you know Mike Flanagan's film.
He's
already kind of proven, you know what it is? It's interesting because I've seen interviews with him and Stephen King, and basically what he says is he learned everything about horror by reading King, because the thing people forget about horror is that there needs to be a warmth to the characters. You have to really, really invest and love them. And you get that in King's books because he always spends so much time kind of filling in who these people are.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like across the board on all his films, going forward. And so if you can imagine him adding that warmth and adapting Dr. Sleep, which I didn't read, but I knew what it was about,
yeah,
kind of, vaguely.
Yeah.
When I realized the significance of the title, though, I, like, lost it in the theater. I, like, cried, like, three times during this movie.
Oh, wow.
That's how, like, literally how warm it is.
Aw.
Wait, you're saying The Shining's not warm?
Well, but here's the magic trick. He actually did make the perfect blend of Kubrick and King. And I wouldn't have believed it if I didn't hear King say it. He's like, Mike found a way to warm up the Kubrick movie. He doesn't hate it as much as he did. He still hates it.
Yeah.
But it's like he actually made me like the Kubrick movie just a little more with the way he handled it here.
That's what every single person that I've heard from has said, is that somehow he took like this appalling, grotesque, like horrible movie and made it feel warm and homey and made you love the characters in it. And that in itself.
The Shining's my favorite horror movie. Well, my favorite movie pretty much of all time, not just horror movie. It's just like, so it's funny that I haven't gone, well, partially because we missed it, but partially because
why you gotta point at me there?
But part of it is like also not knowing, do I want that? Like, I love The Shining as its own piece of art.
I don't think it'll take anything away from The Shining.
No, I would go regardless because I love Flanagan.
It's a fun remember. And also, I love that it's all new actors, like, you know, Alex Esso playing, you know.
That seemed genius.
There's something about your memory of it, seeing these new events. It's really about just picking up a character. It's really a film about trauma and how people really deal with it. Because if you were a six-year-old boy and you went through that, what would that do to you for your whole life? And then you have this power or this ability. Like, would you choose to use it? Would you try to hide it? Like, how does that affect a grown up version of death? And that's what the story is really about. And I think that's fascinating.
Yeah, I think it works on multiple levels because there's a large level of grief. There's a major moment that occurs at the very beginning when you first meet Danny Torrance that weighs on him, that's outside of the Overlook incident and what goes on, that carries through most of the film and carries through to some major decisions that Danny makes. But I mean, like, beyond the story, beyond King, Flanagan's at the top of his game.
Yeah.
There's a moment in the film where it took my breath away. Like, way he crafted it, the music by the Newton Brothers, everything. I mean,
can I go now?
I know.
I'm ready.
Wait for me, because
we're literally
trying to figure out how it can fit in the schedule to go see it again. Okay. It's 2.5 hours, but it flies.
Yeah.
You want to see it tomorrow night? Let's do it.
I'm down. I'm really dying to see it. You guys need to.
Yeah.
We should have
I thought there was moments of Haunting of the House where he was just at the top of his game.
Hands down much better than Hill House. Cool. I mean, in terms
of and I love both.
Yeah.
And there's one, I mean, I don't want to, there are no spoilers at all, but there is one, because obviously he's pulling from the Kubrick movie in certain spots, mostly King, but there are a few things that are him that are not in either version.
Yeah.
And there's one thing in particular he did that is all him that I think is fucking genius, and it was probably my favorite scene in the whole movie. And you'll know it when you see it because it's what bridges everything together.
Yeah. This will be a weird question. Just quickly, and it might be obvious, but you know how the book and the movie have different endings? You know, one is an explosion, right?
Just wait. Go see it.
Interesting. Yeah, I was just curious.
Because I mean, like, that was always the challenge. I mean, I remember when Dr. Sleep, you know, as an entity, you know, a screen adaptation came along, and that was before Flanagan came on. I was like, the greatest hurdle a filmmaker is going to have to figure out is how to balance both what the book, Stephen King book, is and what the Kubrick film is. Because I mean, as far as I think the wide audience is concerned and the world is concerned, you know, Kubrick's film is canon.
It is.
Yeah.
I mean, like, that is Jack Torrance. Jack Nicholson is Jack Torrance. That image of Here's Wendy, you know, all of it. Like, that is canon to a large audience. We have toys and merchandise to remind us
that's
The Shining.
And like, shot types and
absolutely,
steady cams.
Absolutely. The rugs and all of that stuff. So how do you take a sequel to the book that King penned and bring it to the screen and still, like, pay tribute to both? And I think Flanagan just excelled at both. I mean, like, he did such an amazing job. I can't wait to
see actually
him.
Because before, it's just some of the marketing, I was like, okay.
You know, and it's best you don't know anything else. I mean, there's two trailers out there that are great, and I enjoyed revisiting the trailers after I saw the movie to remind me of the things that I loved about it. But the less you know about it, the more rewarding it is. Yeah.
I think Ted Gagan said this really interesting, or maybe it was Andrew Cash. I forgot. Somebody on Facebook – it was really interesting because it was like King went out of his way to not do the typical sequel. Like, mm-hmm. you know, a sequel to The Shining in any other terms is like Return to the Overlook. You encounter ghosts and goblins mm-hmm. again, you know, all that kind of shit. And what King did, and I admit I was kind of a negative Nancy when I first read the synopsis for Dr. Sleep, it was like soul vampires. And I was like, what is that? What the fuck? And I did not read the book because of that. But I was willing to give, you know, the film a chance and be a little bit more open-minded to it. And I think it worked so well because what King was doing was opening up the world as opposed to being so isolated to the Overlook. He opened up the mythology. He opened up, you know, the characters who were living within it. And I think it's terrific.
There's Danny and what's the character's name? Dick O'Hara, yeah. Right? In the original. Mm-hmm. And it's just like his sequel is like, whatever, 20, 30 years later, they can't be the only two that are like that, right? Yeah. So let's bring it back and see what that means. I really loved the book. No, I haven't. I was going to ask you, Ryan, if your dad, because I know your dad's a pretty he didn't read the book either.
No, he didn't read the book either.
He loved the movie.
Yeah, he did love the movie. Yeah. But I mean, I want to go back. Like once I get through the stack that I have, I kind of want to go back and just read it.
Yeah.
You know?
Nice.
But the funny thing is I also watched the Shining 4K Blu-ray that night before.
Oh man, that must have been perfect.
It was
payoff.
A perfect pain. Nice. But it was really interesting is rewatching Stephen King movies through the lens of an adult. Mm-hmm. And you know, I mean, I think that it's something that we take for granted is revisiting movies that we grew up with mm-hmm. and just kind of not looking at them with the adult perception we have now because we're just like, oh, nostalgia. We're feasting on candy.
I'm
again.
Often disappointed if I try.
Yeah,
like if I like rewatch. Watch The Gate and try not to actually the gate. No, the gate holds up. But there's been a number of them that I rewatch and I go, yeah.
But I mean, like The Shining is really interesting because, I mean, like Jack is just such a dick.
Oh my God, and he's a dick from the beginning.
That kind of makes it unique.
No, for sure. I was watching it with my wife, and you know that moment when Wendy comes in and she's just like, "Hey, there's lunch," and he's like typing. And he's just like, "Every time I'm in here," and he's like, and you hear tick tick tick. You know, it's like. And then at the very end, he's just like, no, why don't you just get the fuck out of here? And I was like, ooh, bad form. But, you know, it's just the movie is a fucking masterpiece. I'll always defend it. I love it. But it was just great to see as a warm-up.
Yeah. I think of the colors of that movie so often. Yeah. Like just the green of that bathroom. Oh, things like the bathroom shot where they cross the line.
Yeah.
It's just some brilliant decisions being made. Yeah. Anyway, I can't wait. Well, now you guys have made me way more excited than I was.
Yeah.
So now I'm gonna matter.
I'm better now. Yeah. Suck it. Let's go.
All right.
Jesus. Okay.
Oh, well, we got that to look forward to. Mm-hmm.
But we did watch a couple things. We watched Wounds.
Yes, it was.
Oh.
Yeah.
My second favorite thing.
I had a blast with this one. And I was seeing some vitriol being spilled for it.
No, on Letterboxd, this thing mostly had half-star reviews.
Yeah. Oh.
Yes.
Yeah.
Really?
So Dick told me he loved it. I plugged into it because I really wanted to look at something like using a phone and all that kind of stuff.
And I don't even remember. Oh, we were at school that day. I was at, and you told me about it. And I was like, I'm going to go home and watch me that sucker. And I did. And it was great.
We'll have to avoid spoilers, but I gave it a certain review and I didn't see something at the end. And then Becca made me watch the end again. That gets an extra half star.
He was like, I didn't get the end. It was just this. And I was like, you didn't see?
It's like when you look at those magic eye things. And
I watched it on my iPad and I saw that.
But the one thing it reminded me though is like, I don't love sometimes big stars in horror movies. Like this was one of those horror. Like I thought, what's the name of the actress?
Armie Hammer and Zazie Beetz.
Army's he's good, but like you know he's got a very specific style. But then it was the girl from
Zazie.
Zazie.
From Zazie Beetz.
No, the girl from
Dakota
Suspiria.
Johnson.
Dakota Johnson, who I really in general. In this, it was like such a
it was
strangely
literally
hollow.
Like it was like watching Saltines act.
It was really
like,
there was wow. Just, no, it really kind
no, it really was.
I want that on the poster. That's so good. I'm telling Don Johnson on you.
I was hoping to get Babak on the show.
He's awesome.
He's actually fantastic.
And maybe that's what they were going for because I can't assume that they were making these decisions that this was just her acting choice.
But let's dial it back. So So there's a bartender in New Orleans. There's a big fight in his bar. There's some like hipster young guys and these kind of bigger kind of thuggish rednecky guys. The fight gets really violent. Kind of takes a bad turn. The young people kind of scatter and they seem a little off and strange anyway. They feel like rejects.
They're like acting twitchy.
Yeah, but they leave a cell phone at the end of the night. He takes the cell phone home. Somebody starts writing on the cell phone, please help me with some scary imagery. And it starts opening up this weird alternate dimension, somewhat Lovecraftian touches. And that stuff, everything that is horror related in this movie is awesome.
Yeah.
Like every beat that has a horror beat, it's just some of the other stuff that, but I will say this, when this movie ended, I've never felt a movie, like I was like, wait, there's 30 minutes more, right? And the credits were rolling. I was like, what, where's the other 30? Like I was so ready for more, but it was
such a cool ending. I mean, I have no idea how it went down. I still don't exactly know what I saw for parts of it, but I was so enamored with it the whole way through. And there was some genuinely chilling stuff in there. The sound design on it, because cockroaches, that's not blowing any parts of it. Cockroaches play a big kind of, I'll call it a motif in it. And so kind of how they were able to insert the scuttling and scurrying of cockroaches into some of the atmospheric sounds, like even just kind of room tones. You constantly are always hearing this kind of hum with scuttling underneath. It was really well done.
And this is the director of one you loved a lot, Under the Shadow.
Under the Shadow,
and it's made on Hulu. It was, it's awesome when these things pop up for free and you're like, ooh.
Yeah, it's based on a novella.
I had no fanfare, heard nothing.
It's based on a
listener of the show.
Hulu's not free.
It's free. Just like
none of the streaming is free.
The only one that's not free is Disney Plus.
So yeah, it's based on a book and Ryan and I were just talking about this. It's based on a book called The Visible Filth by Nathan Ballingrud, who also wrote North American Lake Monsters, which was one of my favorite books.
And he definitely listens because I remember Paul Tremblay telling us that.
Yes. I love your writing, Nathan.
Yeah, this was, I believe, Annapurna.
Okay.
I know that it was like, Annapurna that might have produced it. They did. Annapurna, and then they debuted it at Sundance, which is where I saw it, and then Hulu came in and picked it up.
Yeah, it wouldn't have made sense necessarily theatrical to me, but it is like a cool horror to discover.
So wild.
Yeah.
It feels more like a found footage thing, and even though it's not aesthetically, it feels like something you want to discover and go, ooh, what the fuck was that?
Well, the thing, what I liked is I actually liked going on the journey. Mm-hmm. Like, it was so mesmerizing in terms of its kind of hookiness to it, where it was like, oh, you find a phone at a bar, and then on that phone is something really weird and creepy, and then going down that rabbit hole. And it was just, and I think this is where putting familiar faces into the film kind of lured me in even more, because felt like Army was delivering the goods, and I liked his relationship with Zazie, and Dakota was fine too, but I just liked going on that journey with him and seeing how dark and weird it got. Uh-huh. And because it was guided by Babak, I was like, oh, it's gonna go even weirder. And then who's the other actor, his neighbor, his best friend who was at the bar?
The big guy who I thought
was just gonna explode. He felt like he was gonna explode.
Brad William Hinkie.
Yes, he's really good.
Though you know what would be interesting, like, and I agree, I can see why you like those sides of it, but I could also imagine this film set in modern Iran with Iranian actors, but the same story with a bar and with like phone. You'd be like, what would that be like? I think that'd be fucking scary. But anyway, it's interesting.
And I will say that I do think, even though that I did say that her acting in the film was, I have a feeling that it was a character choice, because everyone else in this film is so explosive. They really did just, she had nothing. Like, there was no
character choice, Becca?
That's it, exactly.
Was it a character choice?
It was so flat the whole time.
Yeah, no, it was really, like, it was. I've seen her in a lot of stuff, like a lot of Luca Guadagnino things, where she's always got so much to do. And I was watching, I've seen her in the 50 Shades movies or whatever. And I was just watching this guy, what is going on? Like,
yeah,
why?
Like, she felt like she was in a different movie.
Right now?
yeah, it really did feel like a different movie.
It could also be because Army always operates on like 10. Like, he's a big, energetic, bounding kind of character. But anyway, but highly recommend it for people to check out, because it has so many interesting touches.
Yeah, again, it is called Wounds. And it's quick. It's real quick.
Yeah, no, it is like 85 minutes or something.
Well, Rob, what do you got?
Well, since they mentioned Wounds on Hulu, I watched Little Monsters, which Becca talked about
before
we broke. Oh, yeah. And did you see that at a festival or something?
I saw it early, yeah.
I thought it was pretty cool.
It's cute.
Yeah,
I had a blast with it.
Becca kind of gave us the whole synopsis, which basically it's a teacher with her young students.
Going to like a petting zoo.
Yeah, petting zoo. And one of the kids' uncles, who's a total like fuck
slacker.
Up.
Yeah.
Is that Josh thingy? The
no, that's not Josh Gad.
No. No, he is like a kids show host or whatever considers himself a god, which plays into the plot. And basically they're there. He kind of has the hots for the teacher and a zombie outbreak happens right in the middle of it. And so they're trying to make it a game for the kids so they don't freak out. It was really funny. I had a lot of moments that I laughed out loud, and I just thought the whole thing was good. The only thing that I can say is like I'm just so tired of zombie movies.
So am I.
That I wish this came out like 10 years ago, and I would like it more.
Yeah, 10 years ago, this would have been huge. I think that there's a reason that we didn't get much hype about it, like that we didn't hear anything about it, because it's clearly a big budget movie with big actors and actresses in it. And I think that it is because it's a zombie film.
Yeah. Well, the only one that broke that was Anna and the Apocalypse, and I think that was because it was musical in some ways. Like it was different enough.
Actually, that would actually make a great double feature.
Yeah, they would. Yeah, they feel tonally very similar. Okay. It's kind of this zombie film with heart.
And what you have is, you know, someone of caliber, Lupita Nyong'o, playing the lead in a zombie movie.
Oh, and she looks so light and fun to watch.
I know. Yeah,
she is
very
light and fun.
After staring at her in Us and, you know, all these kind of heavy movies, and then all of a sudden there she is kind of singing Taylor Swift and guiding a bunch of kids out of danger. It's cute. It's fun. Yeah. Really quick, I just want to say, have you guys seen Are You Afraid of the Dark, the Nickelodeon reboot? Mm-hmm. Guys, it is the perfect gateway horror for kids.
Okay, I'm in.
It's a three-part thing. Dean Israelite, who
three-part is in what, like only three episodes?
It's like a mini-series.
Three episodes. It's a reboot of the popular Nickelodeon show from the 90s. There's a big following for it. Ben David Grabinski and a number of others rebooted it for Nickelodeon, and what they did it is in the form of a three-part story as opposed to kind of like the anthological thing that Are You Afraid of the Dark is known for. And Dean Israelite, who is the director of Power Rangers and Project Almanac, he directed all the episodes. Our friend Jared Rivet was on the writers' team. And basically what you have is a story about a young woman, a young girl. I mean, these are like middle school kids who has nightmares of this kind of carnival barker who goes by the name of Mr. Top Hat. And he it's kind of a little Something Wicked This Way Comes. Yeah. Where if his carnival blows into town, kids start to go missing. And she is indoctrinated into the Midnight Society, where they tell spooky stories. And the way she gets into the story, into this club, is by telling a story about her nightmares. But once she does that, then Mr. Top Hat and the actual carnival roll into town. And what she thought was fiction is now reality. And
so it's that one story over three.
It's that one story over three episodes.
What is this on?
It's on Nickelodeon. But you can also you could buy the season pass on iTunes for like $7.99. So you're getting you're basically getting a 3-hour movie for $7.99.
But if you have regular cable, Nickelodeon's in there somewhere.
It's in there somewhere. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But Raphael Cassell plays Mr. Top Hat, and there is some really creepy shit in the show.
Nice.
You know, I was never. Are You Afraid of the Dark fan? It missed my generation, you know. But I just needed something light and breezy to watch, like during the Halloween season.
Becca's like a decade younger than you, so that was more your thing.
No, are you afraid of the dark? Decade. No, Are You Afraid of the Dark hit me right at the right time. That was like sixth grade for me.
Got it.
And
got
so
it.
Those were huge for me. Goosebumps was a little bit later, but I still watched them all just out of principle. Right. That came when I was in high school, but I still watched them all. But Are You Afraid of the Dark was like fifth, sixth grade.
Yeah.
So Ryan was finishing college.
But it's real. But the cast of kids are fantastic. They get the right rhythm and tone of just cool kids that love horror.
I thought it was a TV series. That's why I didn't kind of bother. I thought it was like 12
episodes.
So did I. Uh-huh. And then I don't know what happened, but Ben, the kid who plays Ben Hapscombe in It.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He's in it, and he plays like a horror fan. I think I saw him wearing like the Gate t-shirt.
That's awesome. Well, yeah, there's be. Like, there's I mean, like Ben fun, would put that stuff
yeah, yeah,
in.
Ben David would put that in. But there's a lot of great references. But the story, you know, there's some just really creepy, fun stuff. And there's one moment, and I talked to Jared about this over the weekend. There's just a moment where this girl wakes up and she finds Mr. Top Hat at the top of her, like lying on her ceiling, staring at her. And without saying a word, he just mouths, "Watch this." And he starts to do a magic trick. And it the way he delivered it literally sent chills in my spine. I rewound it and I was like, that is terrific. Like, this is what kids should be watching to get themselves into the genre, you know? But great production design. And it's and I hope that – I mean, apparently it did very well for Nickelodeon. I hope they do a season two and they keep to, keep exploring more stories, you know, because I like the kids. The kids were great.
Okay. No, and that, just knowing it's not a 12-part thing, I'm going to watch it.
Three is a lot less of a commitment.
Definitely. Marnie's been burning her way through Goosebumps. We're now on to, I think, season three. But what cracks me up is she's great with every single one of them, but Slappy, the little puppet, scares the crap out of her. And she won't let me turn it off, but she wants to watch it over and over, but she burrows her face in the pillow every single time he comes on screen.
One of mine didn't even want to go trick-or-treating because there could be Slappies out there. That's how scared of that they were.
Wow. My gosh.
Speaking of Slappy, I can tie this on in quickly.
Where is this going?
I apologize. I apologize, Rob. I'm about to contradict. I did see the new Child's Play film.
Oh, okay.
And
contradict
I did
me all you want,
really,
pal.
Really enjoy it.
How and why?
I probably never would have watched it in general, but then I started seeing a lot of people say they liked it, and I was like, I'm not going to like this. And I think what I liked was it's just not even the same universe. So instantly I wasn't comparing it. Like once I broke from, okay, so totally different universe. It's nothing to do with the other Child Play. It's not even a spirit of a doll. You know what I mean? Yeah. Once I got into that, I think the flair the director had, is somebody who made a film just this year. Like I think it's a brand new young voice making this movie. I felt like they did a lot of things visually that were really fun. I thought the setup was interesting. I didn't love it. Don't get me wrong. I'm not going to come on here and go, this is the best movie. But I was so shocked how fun I found it to be, which is weird. I thought the clever dialogue thing, I love the casting, the mom, obviously, but I'm sure you love that too, even if you didn't like the movie. I don't know what it was. I was just surprised. I guess it was, I hadn't read anything. You know, I knew how you felt. I knew how some people felt. That's about all I knew.
Can I make a confession? Can I interject something? Yeah, yeah. So the director who did Child's Play did a film called Polaroid.
Yeah.
Now, I know all you motherfuckers didn't watch Polaroid, but I rented it the day it came out on iTunes. I didn't hate it. I know it got super.
That got on the poster, right? I didn't hate it.
I didn't hate it. I mean, like, here's the thing.
That's what I'm saying about Child's Play. I didn't hate it.
Yeah, that's all. You know, I mean, like, the thing about Polaroid is that if it came out in 1997, it's a perfect time.
With
Joshua Jackson. I mean, because it's basically about a Polaroid. If you take a photo, it's like a haunted Polaroid camera. And if you take a photo and something happens to that image of you, Elric, like someone puts a match to it or something, then you catch on fire.
Oh, yeah. All
so there's some spoon. I mean, it's
I don't
super...
know if I like this picture.
Yeah.
That's a little...
From Polaroid?
From Child's Play.
Anyways, continue with Child's Play.
Very well lit.
I wouldn't say too much. Like, I wouldn't want to overhype it by any means, but at least I understand now why people enjoyed it. I think for me, had this still been part of that same franchise, I wish... you might have felt this way too. I know you probably were blinded by the rage, but I think I wish he wasn't ever called Chucky.
Oh yeah, yeah.
No, I think it would have been better as a good guy doll with a totally different history.
Yeah, that's the problem. And this is the problem with remakes or sequels. It's impossible to separate when you. If I'd walked into a theater that was just, you know, called I don't know Joe the doll or whatever the hell.
As a doll,
maybe
and kid
I would have been
movie,
like, "Well, this
good
is
one.
Stupid," but it's fun.
Yeah, no, it had a lot of gags, and it had I like the kid. I think that kid actor was very good. Yeah. It's going for more of a Stranger Things age, so it makes sense. Yeah. You can kind of have an adventure with a kid that age. I don't know. I was surprised. I actually genuinely enjoyed myself. It's not going to be on my best of list. Don't worry.
Oh, thank God.
But I did like
We're
it.
Still friends.
And it sometimes helps to have a lower bar. Like I had a low bar.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
I think what I also
helps.
Liked it was quite a big movie, and I mean that in terms of like it. I was expecting maybe like a lot of sequels get cheaper and cheaper. This felt like I had a bit of money put in it. Never once did it feel like a low budget little thing, which I think suited it. Like it suited to having what looked to me like a pretty nice style. But again, I feel dirty. I almost didn't want to show up and do the show today. I knew
I'd
blown your
gaze. Here's a washcloth and some soap, Elric.
I feel bad.
And I just added Polaroid to my watch list.
Listen.
It's got very high reviews.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh. Well, listen.
Like everyone was like shockingly good was like the predominant
before
review.
I see. Yeah. Well, the problem with Polaroid was a bastard child of the whole Dimension thing. When Dimension collapsed, they didn't know
how
what to do with it. This is like 2 years ago.
Okay.
But they apparently like sold it to Netflix, and Netflix was like, I don't want that. And it was pure financial stuff. But let me, before anybody starts tweeting at me, Ryan recommended Polaroid. I just want to say, It just surprised me. Uh-huh. I didn't, you know, I went along for the journey and just let go.
I think when you open with saying I didn't hate it, I don't think you're overselling something. I think that's a safe
Somebody
admission.
Has said that when I say that, it means the film's utterly garbage.
Oh, really?
Somebody said that on Facebook. When Becca says, I didn't hate it, yes. The film was garbage.
Actually, no, you're right. Some of us do have codes that can learn if we're silent for 2 hours. We all have our ticks.
We all have our ticks. It's true.
You should know them by now.
I have baseball signals.
It's true, it does. One that I was surprising about it, In Tall Grass, which I think you watched as well, Rob.
Yeah,
I really liked this one. I was so skeptical about this because I'd read the novella and was very much like, it's literally just about people walking around grass. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a lot of like relationship stuff, but it's just people walking around grass. I really enjoyed this
one. So did I. Elric, did you see this yet?
No.
What's wrong with you? It's Vincenzo Natale.
I know.
What's wrong with
you? And I will say that when that I knew it was Vincenzo Natale going in, and then I saw where somebody posted up on Twitter that it was like beat for beat Cube, and I was like,
I mean, just the idea of it's just like a bigger budget Cube in terms of playing with the same setting.
Sure.
And
this is King and Joe Hill together.
And I'd always loved the story because it's so simple. And I mean, like, when you drive cross country, because I used to drive from Virginia to California, literally, I would spend an entire day just driving through fields of just grass, just nothing. And so I remember reading this around the same time that I was doing these treks back and forth. I think it was like 2011, 2012 that the book came out. And it functions really, really well where it is like, can you just have a horror about people meandering around a field? And it works so well. And I was so skeptical about how they would turn it into a 90-minute movie. And it really does work. Small complaints, like there was a couple things that didn't work for me, but not much. It was enough that I definitely would like recommend this to everybody to check out. And Patrick
horror
Wilson.
Horror or sci-fi hard?
Oh, it's horror.
Oh, it's like Lovecraftian horror.
Lovecraftian.
Twilight Zone-esque. Like the setup feels very Twilight Zone. It gave me anxiety, and I think I talked about it when we had Eggers on, maybe that episode. Yeah. But just the one scene that like made like creep me out was just like obviously these people get lost in a field, and they're like, "Where are you? Just jump up so I can see you." Yeah. And they jump, and then they're like, "Okay, jump again." And when they jump again, they're like so much further apart.
Yeah. They've like moved completely.
And so that was just one really cool visual cue to like make me like, holy shit, what would I do? Because that's a lot of grass all around. So no, it's cool.
I'll watch it before next week.
Yeah, and I will say that one of the things that I loved about the book that they were able to preserve is the book unapologetically explains nothing. Like it doesn't feel compelled to answer every question. I was dreading that when they turned it into a feature that some executive was going to be like, well, we need to put some explainers in there. And they do to a very small degree, enough just to keep you kind of like breadcrumbed along on the journey. But it was great.
Yeah, cool. And Patrick Wilson's in it.
Mm-hmm. And he's good.
So he kind of like he like lends a little bit of acting weight to it all.
He's becoming a horror icon.
I love that guy.
Yes. He was wearing a Fangoria 1979 t-shirt.
He was.
Some award show. I thought that was cool.
Rob, lay it on me. I want to hear
about what?
My favorite title.
What's
you just lent me?
What? Oh, no. I'm
you
not
can't talk about it yet?
I'm going to talk. He's talking about Berserker from Vinegar Syndrome.
Wait, but it's on my list, too, to talk about.
Today?
Okay, so wait. All right, so wait for me.
What is it? I'll watch it this week.
It's Berserker. It's about a...
It's your favorite
it's
title?
It's Berserker.
No,
it's not his favorite.
Definitely
I was being
not my
facetious.
Favorite title at all.
I was being facetious.
Let's wait till Ryan
wait for me
catch
to see
up
it. Wait
this.
For me to see
I'm
it.
I'm not going to say anything about it, but you should not look at my letterbox.
Okay.
Wait,
well,
which?
I have
one other Vinegar Syndrome that I will mention today.
All I'm going to say is I posted like the opening title sequence, which is like this awesome 15 seconds.
Is this it on Rift Tracks?
And Ryan replied to me being like, what the hell is that? And I was like, when I finished, I was like, I'm just going to lend it to you, okay?
It's shot in Wisconsin, but as somebody said, how did Vikings wash up into the middle of America with
Viking movie. There is a Riff Tracks version that is streaming Prime.
I don't know
on,
if that's the same one. It doesn't have bear imagery on it.
It's going to be so
it
hard
is
to bottle
a Viking
this,
movie with unique twist. Yes. Well, I have, that's all accurate.
My back catalog, I have Unmasked Part 25. Okay. I need to watch.
I want to see
that. Oh, yeah. That one's so interesting.
Can I save you time on another title called Chill Factor?
Sure.
Don't do it. Done. Safe. No, we did a Chill Factor Berserker double feature, and it was a misguided double feature that I highly recommend no one ever do. Like, literally, we did the first one. I won't tell you. Well, when Ryan leaves the room for a moment, I will reveal. We started with Berserker, and we were all like, oof. And the fun kind of left the room. There's a couple moments, but we were kind of like, oof. And then we got, okay, but this one looks really fun. Chill Factor. It's kind of a ski resort. Think it's some sort of satanic demon thing. They're all on thing. Watch that one. Double oof. That film, man. I think, might be the lowest star rating I've given.
And that's an Arrow release, right?
That was Arrow. Yeah. That was Arrow. It's kind of baffling.
Arrow and Vinegar Syndrome are neck and neck for the Russian roulette.
Who can do it?
It was a brute. No, these two did not work well together at all. But I mean, Chill Factor like had a cool setup. Then it's just like so boring and nothing's happening for long stretches. And you're just like totally baffled by that. But yes, we'll table our Berserker talk.
Yeah, let's table it for next week. It needs to be discussed as a group.
Yeah,
I'm going to do some rapid fire stuff just because it's you know titles that we've talked about a lot. So there's a great museum here called the Autry, which is kind of like a Western museum, and they do screenings all the time. And once in a blue moon, I'll see some oddball like genre thing. They had a film print the last week of October of John Carpenter's Vampires.
Ooh,
wow. And Vampires, I know, you know, Ryan and I were in the height of our fandom when that came out in theaters, and yet I did not see it in theaters. Yeah. I think I saw it on video.
Dude, I even read the book right before it came out.
Oh, my God, yeah.
It's actually pretty good.
I read the script and saw the movie.
So we were all in on Vampires. But here's the funny thing. So I've never been a huge fan of this movie. There's things about it I like, but I've never really liked it that much. So they had a film print, but this was actually fascinating. So they had a print of it, but they only had one projector working. So every 20 minutes, they had to stop and be like, we can put the Blu-ray on, or if you wait a minute, we'll just go to the next reel. And we're like, no, keep the film. Keep going. Yeah. That movie works great with 20-minute breaks.
Catch your breath.
Like, it needs an intermission.
Yeah. But also, I can't – it actually worked for me on the big screen. Uh-huh. Like, it's actually very well shot.
I remember when we did the Carpenter episode on the other show, I was saying that's the one thing about it. He has a lot of chops in this film.
Yeah.
It's just some of the ugliness. It's some of the stuff it between all, Sherilyn Finn and Baldwin that's just so ugly.
It doesn't come together. But then again, this was also the first time that their whole thing is just eradicating vampires. Yeah. And they already know that she is one.
Yeah.
So, there's that thin line like – yeah, you don't like a guy treating a woman that way, but he's actually treating her like a vampire, even though she isn't.
Yeah, it's just the way he plays. And it's nothing wrong with the performance. It's the kind of character so unlike Mother, you're like, oh. But then, Woods is funny.
But again, I just thought, like, on film, on the big screen, it just felt like every Western is bigger is better on the big screen as well. So it just felt, I don't know, it's the first time I actually really thoroughly enjoyed it. And part of it was every 20 minutes, like, kind of turning over to the people next to me being like, oh, it's kind of interesting where we left off now. It's felt like a serial.
Amazing.
So, yeah, if you get to see it on a film print with 20-minute breaks, I think you'll enjoy it immensely.
Awesome.
So that was Vampires. Let's see what else.
Did you guys see – because we didn't talk about this one, but it came out. What, did you see Haunt?
No, not yet.
Okay. Yeah, because that did seem like
it's on Shudder now, I think.
Yeah. I mean, it's like it didn't completely work for me, but there's moments of it that were funny and surprising. The creature stuff.
I think it's one of the rare movies where the back half of the movie works so much better than
which
the front.
Which is really surprising. With
because
you're
generally,
right.
Horror movies have
great setups, high concept, and then it
then
falls apart.
They don't know how to end it. Yeah. This one wrapped on such a great note. I was like, cool.
Yeah, and I start very close to Halloween, so I would recommend you might want to wait even until next. But it definitely felt it in the season. But I think you might dig it. I didn't love it or anything, but I did think where it – I agree with you. Okay. I think where it went was actually pretty interesting. Just wondered if you had seen that one.
Not yet. And I picked up from Ronin Flicks, a.k.a. Code Red, Conquest. Fulci's Conquest.
I've got the DVD from
them.
It's sitting on my shelf, too.
It is something else.
Yeah. When in Fulci's career did this fall?
Late.
Oh, late 80s. It's like him trying to do Beastmaster, but with a lot of gore.
So this would have been like – Yeah, hold on. Pulling it up.
We've been meaning to do a fantasy episode of the other one. That's top of my pile. I'm waiting to watch Conquest.
Now there's a semi-decent looking Blu-ray of it. Like the first reel looks terrible for whatever reason, but then this Blu-ray actually gets better. Mm. I will say this. There is a sequence where our guy, whatever
reticent
the hell he
the word
is.
Hero, huh?
Yeah, very reticent. There is a zombie sequence, and it's actually one of the best zombie sequences Fulci's ever done.
Oh, shit.
Well, right in the middle of the movie, they're coming out of the water, and they look like all like corroded and stuff.
Wow. This is like, right, 83, this is awesome. And it's like a sword and sandal, it looks like.
It's a sword and sandal, but I mean, it's like the gore is just so outrageous. It's Fulci gore.
I'm in.
I left a Cinefamily back when Phil was programming the Cinefamily all-nighter. Because I think the New Bev was down years ago.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I stayed up all night. It was 5 a.m. They played like Eric of the Mall, Phantom of the Mall, whatever. Yeah, yeah. And I was like, went home. And the next
you
movie.
You Phantom of the Mall?
No, I was eh.
No, you do not.
I was. I left. And then the next movie was Conquest.
Oof.
So I missed it. So they ended on Conquest the whole
yeah,
movie.
That would.
Fuck you,
it's an ender
Phantom
movie.
Of the Mall. Do I even know you? Nah. Stop that.
I'm kind of, agreeing with Elric.
There's no chopping mall.
Phantom of the Mall at like 4 a.m.
There's no chopping mall.
Nothing can be chopping mall.
Yeah, I don't know if I could have done
that. I still own Phantom of the Mall on VHS.
Yeah, but at 5 a.m., you have to make decisions, life decisions, you know?
He haunts that mall around the clock, okay. Man.
Yeah, so Conquest is on Blu-ray now, believe it or not. Hey. There you go. Last thing I want to mention is this little book I have here, which I know Ryan just picked up.
Yeah.
I'm almost done with it. I've got a little bit more to go, but this is from Dustin McNeil and Travis Mullins. And Dustin, I got to give him a shout out. He's been pumping out books like this for horror franchise stuff. His research is meticulous. He wrote Slash of the Titans, which goes through all 10 iterations of the Freddy vs. Jason script chronological order, which is amazing. And this is the same thing. It's called Taking Shape, Developing Halloween from Script to Scream. And it focuses on the Halloween movies that came out. It's from John Carpenter's all the way to yours, Ryan. So I'm looking forward to reading.
I noticed that when I picked it up.
The dirt on the let's see how accurate the development
Very
of yours
curious.
Is.
I know.
Oh, you haven't read this yet?
No, I literally just got it this week. Okay,
cool. But again, as a diehard fan and having watched like every documentary and read everything, you always wonder, is there gonna be new stuff? And there is. It's really, really fascinating hearing. I mean, again, he goes through like every draft of every script of the movie that got made. Yeah. And, you know, everything from like Joe Dante being the first choice for Halloween 3 to, you know, all the stuff on Halloween 5 is incredible.
I can't wait. Well, what's interesting is at the end of the book, they tease the next book, which is all of the sequels that never got made.
Yep.
So I'm very curious about that as well.
That's early next year, I believe. But yeah, this is an excellent book. So
excellent. I'm going to quick fire a couple. So I've been watching Dracula. Which, if you guys,
what the hell is this Dracula thing?
Oh my god, it's so
about?
Fun! It is. It's like a RuPaul's Drag Race drag show like a drag contest, but it's all about recreating dark images, horror stuff. It originally ran on YouTube because I had a couple of my students send me YouTube links to it, and then it's been on Out TV. I discovered it because I was on Queer Wolves a couple of weeks ago with Darren Stein, who's the guy who directed Jawbreaker. One of my favorite movies from the 90s. And he was like, how are you not watching this, Becca? This is like everything that you love in the world. And he was fucking right. And so I will say, it's fantastic. Like drag and horror combined. It's just wonderful.
Where'd you watch it?
I've been watching it on...
It's like Bravo?
Bravo. Yeah, it'd be one of the apps. It was something I paid like $1.99 a month for. And I was like, I'll just binge this. And it's totally fucking worth it. So I highly recommend it. So I've been watching that. Sweetheart. I checked out Sweetheart, which was the Blumhouse movie that went to, it's on Amazon
J.D.
right
Dillard,
now.
Yeah.
Somebody else really told me that they really liked it.
I loved it. I mean, it's literally, it's like Castaway with a monster. If there was a monster on the island, a girl is shipwrecked, washes up on this island. We spend the first part of the movie watching her kind of get her shit together and figure out how she's going to survive. And the first night she's there, she realizes that there's some type of like giant malevolent beast on the monster that comes out of the ocean every
Aquatic
night
horror.
To feed. Totally my jam. I will say that I was a little disappointed when I finally saw that. Like I wanted the creature to look a little bit better. Bipedal. It's always whenever they go bipedal, I'm like, oh. But that said,
spoiler.
Bipedal. No, what? It's a thing.
I'll tell you.
Bipedal's not a
offline,
spoiler, motherfucker.
Offline, I'll tell you some design ideas or a design conversation.
Yeah, I think that was just it. Is maybe I would have gone something different.
Well, no, there's stuff
it.
That I don't think that was unpacked in the movie because there's just not time and you just can't get into it, but in the design process, there was some fun stuff that was discussed that,
oh,
you know,
nice.
That's there, but it's just like you can't see it.
Yeah, I will say the first time you see it in like a silhouette, yeah. I was like, oh, fuck, this is amazing. Yeah. And yeah, and then it kind of lost steam at the end. Yeah. But that said, even with that, it was still I had a blast with it. Absolutely yeah. loved it. It was a great setup. And even when some more characters get involved in it, it was still good. And then the last one is by far the most batshit thing that I've seen in a long time. So I watched this 1992 Dutch horror. By the way, I cannot name another Dutch horror film. So 1992 Dutch horror film, The Johnsons. Has anyone seen The Johnsons?
I saw it because a couple of one of my films film school teachers was involved in this.
Yes.
And so that we created.
Wait, not the street trash guy.
Yeah.
Oh,
so became wait, how is he involved in that?
I forgot. He either, right there.
Guest number four,
I believe. Frumkes. Oh, my God. Right, he wrote it.
Well, we don't talk about Frumkes in a positive light these days, apparently. So.
No, we do.
Rocco Simonelli.
Oh, God. What did he
they
do?
Were both teachers. Oh, he got me too'd at SVA.
There's some stuff at school. But also, they were dating students back in their
what
day
the
at
fuck?
That school.
I don't know the full story.
Okay,
but
well,
I was,
fine. Yeah. He was just one of the writers. But that said, it's an interesting film. And I say interesting. As in, it's got a couple of different plots. There's a teenage girl, and she gets her period, and at the same time, so we're getting this girl who's kind of getting her period for the first time. It's flashing to these, like, test tube babies that are all the same, and then we're also getting these kind of stories that there is, like, this god that is going to be reborn and impregnate a virgin, and it's all three going on at the same time. There's a lot going on. Like, it's a very complicated plot, but that said, it's got some really interesting horror imagery in it. The creature, I'm not even going to say this right, the Zangoxix, I don't know, but it's an interesting film. If you're into weird international things that you have never fucking seen before, this qualifies.
You have seen other Dutch films, though, because we've talked about Amsterdam.
Oh, yeah. Okay, you're right. Amsterdam.
And whatever else that guy made.
The Lift.
The Lift.
Yeah,
down,
The Lift.
Whatever, yeah.
Yeah, Amsterdam's amazing.
But there isn't a lot.
So,
yeah.
There's definitely not. I mean, I think technically Human Centipede may be a Dutch horror film as well.
Like that, yeah.
But yeah, like Amsterdam and The Lift, you're right. They definitely qualify. But I'll say this is, I could count them all on one hand now. But yeah, it was fascinating, and I don't think they were doing anything else like this in like 1992, and it's got really good effects to it as well.
So wild.
So, yeah.
I'll do a quick recap and then we'll bring in our guests. I am loving American Horror Story.
I've heard the new season is great.
It has outpaced Murder House for me, which is the best one. It is so good. And,
yeah, really?
And they stay in their lane.
Okay.
Like, they're staying in the lane. They're not going and, like, there are...
Elric doesn't believe you.
Yeah, it's kind of been hard to believe.
No, because there are moments, you know, in previous American Horror Stories where they get to the midpoint and then they veer wildly off course.
Yeah.
Yep. Here, they're sticking to the summer camp theme. Huh. And what they've done is they made Richard Ramirez one of the main characters.
Oh.
It's so fucking weird. Huh. But they're on episode 7 or 8 now. I love it.
So there's still time for it to jump the shark. You still have a
couple episodes. No, because they've taken a path that's kind of like one part Jeffrey Rush in House on Haunted Hill.
which
is
Dylan McDermott was just in an episode where he was basically fucking Rucker Hauer in The Hitcher. So it was a big tip of the hat to The Hitcher. There was all this kind of crazy shit, but I fucking love it.
Okay.
And then on Halloween, the weekend before Halloween, we went to a haunted attraction. Had a little bit too much fun, and the next day I needed to recover. Mm-hmm. But I was in the hotel room, and Sci-Fi and AMC were both playing Wrong Turn Marathons and Final Destination Marathons. Mm-hmm. I came in watching Joe Lynch's Wrong Turn 2.
Starring Matthew Curry Holmes.
Starring Matthew Curry Holmes, and I had not seen it since, it came out on DVD. A lot of fun, and then I sat down and we watched the first Wrong Turn. And they're apparently rebooting it in some way, shape, or form, but I kind of miss seeing Wrong Turn being handled in a wide theatrical way because there's a lot of fun to be had in the first Wrong Turn. It's well directed. There's some really fucking weird shit in it. It's incredibly violent, and it just satisfies so much as a horror. You know, you want as a horror.
It's pretty slick and quite big.
It's very slick and very big. But then on the other side was Final Destination, and I just love that franchise.
Yeah, it's
like, we need some more.
Yeah.
So that's where I segue. Let's bring on our guests.
Oh, I didn't even realize that. So that's news to me.
Yeah, that is news.
I mean, I knew Craig Perry was still kicking around.
Wait. Oh, my God. Okay,
no, they were announced to do six or whatever they're going to wind up doing.
Oh, that's awesome.
Tonight's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by Slasher Crasher, the debut horror comedy novel of David Nora. It was the night he tried to go home, but he got caught in their drama. It's Halloween. Nick Roche, a towering figure of evil and stupidity, escapes from upstate New York's mental hospital, where he's been committed for the past 5 years. Planning to return to his childhood home, where he murdered his babysitter's boyfriend, his plans are halted when he crosses paths with an even more terrifying beast. Two high school friends with some serious beef. Caught up in a battle of loyalty that has been brewing for 10 years of their friendship, the two girls, Kathleen Strife and Betsy Coleman, force the feud into a savage showdown, pitting the escaped monster against each other. Who will survive this epic death match? And is it totally wrong to fall in love with the murderous lunatic who just tried to kill your best friend with a machete? It's available on Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, and at BlackRoseWriting.com. For more information, you can find David Nora on Twitter and Instagram at David Nora Jr.
Welcome back. My awkward segue about Final Destination does play some relevance because these two gentlemen who are joining us were announced earlier this year to be partaking in a Final Destination reboot. Maybe we'll get something out of them. Maybe we won't. Let's welcome to the show Patrick Mellon and Marcus Dunstan.
Did you just call me Patrick Mellon?
No, Melton. Okay. Hang on, let me try this again. Patrick Mellon and Marcus Dunstan.
Thank you, everyone.
Tell us everything about the new Final
Everything. The intro's
not over
go.
Yet. This has been a good year for the gentlemen. Not only have they been announced to be part of the Final Destination universe, they were also part of Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. Mm-hmm. And,
which I have questions about.
And if you turn to Hulu right now, I'm not sure. Marcus, did you direct or did you co-direct?
Directed The Pilgrim and wrote it with my friend of over two decades.
Okay.
I don't direct. I show up around lunch.
Oh, cool.
Yes.
Eat, talk, and then leave an hour later.
And what we're talking about is Pilgrim, which is a Thanksgiving horror film that is part of the Hulu Into the Dark series that was originated with our very own Noah Feinberg, who is an assistant here.
Yes.
Oh. Because it's based on a true account.
Wait, what? Really?
Yes.
Wow.
In which his family welcomed these Thanksgiving reenactors into their home.
Yeah. Wow.
If you see the final credit, after the credits, there's a picture of him with this pilgrim. It's pretty amazing.
Oh my god!
Wow! Oh my gosh!
Speaking of Thanksgiving movies, you are wearing an old style T-shirt, which is the beer of choice in Blood Rage.
That's right.
In the end, so we were talking about a special Blood Rage party we're going to connect.
You should reach out now. How can we get some
old
style beer in LA?
We'll do Blood Rage and Pilgrim for Thanksgiving. This can become a new tradition.
Let's do it.
I'm so into this.
We need it. 14
days.
We're
having our Shockwaves giving.
Yeah, Shockwaves giving. Yeah.
We only have beer, guys.
And also, we were talking about ink earlier this show. And Patrick, you seem to have new ink on your forearm. Is this a totem of all the films you've worked on?
I love the Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark head collector. Up top.
There's some that need to be added.
What's on the inside arm?
This isn't
done yet. Okay.
So we see the collector. We see Jigsaw.
Go to our Instagram to play along.
Which one's the Pilgrim?
Collector. Well, that needs to be added. The Pilgrim one. Pilgrim Neighbor and Piranha 2 or Piranha 3 EE haven't quite made it.
But I would just do a picture of John Gulliger.
Yeah,
well, I think John deserves
Gulliger.
I agree.
He was with you guys at the start, so he deserves to be on your body.
It's not a bad idea. Just Gulliger.
Put his face on your face.
Gulliger. I have his cameo in Tangerine on my back, which is just him naked in a room.
Or you could just do one of those neck tattoos like Danny Trejo has, but it's just Gulliger's face on your neck.
We were going to get t-shirts. I don't know, but it was What Would Gulliger Do?
Oh, yeah. Someone made that, sure. Yeah. Well, he helped on Pilgrim. He shot all that Super 8 footage.
So oh, my gosh.
Everything we do, it has to have a bit of Gulliger.
Wait a second.
It's just wonderful.
Wait a minute.
Gulager was part of a Blumhouse production?
Hey! Yes. Yes.
This is amazing.
That's the Trojan horse way.
We won. Yes. We won.
I just love it. Well,
and, you guys just conquered Blumhouse.
Yeah. Well, how about this? And the gratitude goes right to Ryan for right before I walked into meeting number one to meet with the powers that be here. You just said, oh, yeah, you're not going to screw this up. Thanks, man. And I got a hug and a chest bump, and I went in. And now we're sitting at this end of the glory.
Now everybody, everybody wonders what Ryan does here at Blumhouse, I wait for directors in the lobby and go, you got this, bro? And give him a big hug.
And then you chest and bump him. And chest bump him.
It was awesome. Like, it was the perfect.
And if anybody's wondering why I was the Gulager information is new, is because all of the Hulu Into the Dark stuff is spearheaded by our Blumhouse television side.
Which is across the street. In terms of buildings, right? For those who don't know,
it's right around.
It's right there.
It's right next to my
house.
Oh, what's across the street?
Post-production.
All this time,
post-production and all stuff. Yeah. let's start at let's start at the top of 2019 because I'm very curious about Final Destination.
Yes.
Okay. Obviously, you guys put your stamp on Saw, and obviously, you know, Craig Perry is probably not going to allow us to hear too much about what you guys have involved. You know, what you're getting involved with, but. Where are you at, and are you excited?
Well, it's at the key point of getting thumbs up, and you mentioned the key name, Craig Perry, and his producing partner Sheila.
Mm-hmm.
Every single word and scene and is put through an aquifer of their passion and their protective instincts on this, because the Final Destination movies are that cut above in terms of enjoying the dark humor of a good backfired plan of all of us that have that handshake with life where we know at some point we're going to have to pay our price for it. And there's a fresh voice for it now because there's been enough time between the last one, which had a perfect bow ending.
Yeah.
And now to be like, well, what if we brought up the conversation again and put some new gas in the tank but really kept the great Craig and Sheila. They're like, all right, we've done that. We can do this better. We can do that better. Let's make this great. Mm-hmm. And that's been a really fulfilling experience.
Well, it's fun rewatching the Final Destination movies on Sci-Fi and seeing what a cultural impact they've had on society. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, it can't go. Yes. You know, every time I see someone on Instagram, it's like, logging truck. Oh, man, it's Final Destination.
Yes. Oh, totally.
granted, some of the other, you know, entries in this franchise haven't had as much of an impact. But I think, like, you know, what was amazing to me was watching, I forgot what entry had the LASIK disaster.
Five.
Which I showed in my class last year. Craig came in to talk.
There was a fucking LASIK commercial in the commercial breaks. Yep. LASIK actually bought ads on AMC's Veerfest, which was very good. But I like to think that was like a knowing wink, you know.
Sure, absolutely.
But it's one of those franchises where it's centered around the greatest villain, which is death, and death that you can't see. And I think people just love that stuff so much.
Jeffrey Reddick just nailed it. But go ahead.
I was going to say, I think people forget, like, in 2000. That you know, like, we were always looking, how do you reinvent the slasher, right? Because we had the slashers in the 80s, and then, like, Scream did the meta approach. But I've always argued the first Final Destination is a modernized slasher, except the villain, you don't see them at all. But all the setup for it is literally the same as the slasher. And so I always thought that was so interesting. And you never thought of it having a sequel before because – Jeffrey wrote it as an X-Files episode initially.
Yes. Yeah.
And then expanded it. I think originally you were supposed to see something, that it was supposed to be something, right? When Jeffrey wrote it?
I'm not sure about that. I have his X-Files spec that it was originally based on. Yeah. Which is kind of cool.
Okay. So what do you think it is? So, because, you know, we've gotten deep into it, and you talk to different people, and some people have a perception of, this is what this is what's trying to kill them, or is it like the coincidental type thing, or is it the Rube Goldberg, or what is it to you?
Because fate.
I'd always thought fate.
You know, you take a step left instead of right when you were supposed to go left, and it throws the balance off. You know, you were supposed to go left, right. So
but
fate.
If you recall, though, like you said, there was something, and in the first one. It was the wind, and then there was like a shadow.
And then like a radio.
And a dark figure you would almost see as a shadow.
Yeah.
And then, but then in two, didn't have that. And then three did. And then four didn't. And then five kind of had a balance between the two.
Yeah.
Five, not a lot of – I mean, 5 didn't do as well as people as the previous ones, right. I think. But it's excellent. It's really well done. I mean, you know, it's like – and you step back and saw who did it. It was, you know, Eric and Dauberman was involved with
That's right.
There's some real genre people, heavyweights, that really understood it. And the actors were quite great.
And part 6 of Follows is great, too. I love It Follows. unofficial, maybe, but whatever.
Well, I remember the great thing, the beauty of 5 was that nobody knew when it took place.
Yeah.
It hadn't been leaked, ambiguous throughout the whole thing.
It was not so brilliantly done in that regard.
But also, it ties into mythology again, right? Because I don't like 3 and 4 because 3 and 4. I remember distinctly being at a Weekend of Horrors in Brooklyn, New York, when they were going to preview Final Destination 2. Mm-hmm. And the general vibe, and you know horror fans, was like, oh, why are they going to make another one of those? Mm-hmm. And they showed us the highway crash scene, which everyone was floored by.
Yep.
And then they started talking about it, and they explained, like, this is kind of the leftover from what happened in 1, in terms of, like, people that didn't die because of the people that survived 1, etc. So what I'm getting at is, oh, that's cool. They're expanding mythology and changing the rules a little bit. And then 3 and 4, to me, just felt like one-offs doing the same concept. Mm-hmm. And then 5 kind of brought it all around again. So I don't know. How important is that to you guys, or are you kind of taking it – like as if you're starting over again?
Oh, well, that's, or can you those, not say? Those are the answers that would get us in trouble.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's like, of all the secrets we could possibly have, that's such a big one. Like, what is it ultimately going to be?
But as fans, you know, because we've seen the five of them and you come in, so we had the same feelings and thoughts that I'm sure this entire room had. And so we tried to approach it in that way. And Craig, you know, and Sheila are really aware and in tone and in touch, you know, and they understand what worked and what didn't work. And so, you know, hopefully we got the right balance, but we're very aware of these questions you're asking.
I like that. We had not judgmental. Well. Like you're asking, what is it? Like in your, I think your answer is correct, but it solves 2 slasher problems, right? Mm-hmm. The big one is that the characters in slashers tend to be deeply unlikable and you tend to kind of partially want them to be killed. And then you start to identify with the killer, right? And that's all the way through all the Friday 13th. Mm-hmm. It's very hard. And this isn't the case. Most of the characters become likable. You actually start to decide. There's always a couple, you know. But I really like that. But also not unmasking a killer is a huge problem when you try to sit down to write a slasher. You then go, it becomes a Scooby-Doo thing.
Yep.
And it's so hard to break. So by avoiding those 2 cliches, I think it gave it a whole different, you know, sense.
Well, plus, it always let the character stay one step ahead of death, which is a weird thing if you think about it in terms of a slasher, where literally they're staring at pictures of how they're going to die, or there was always something that would give them kind of an indicative order. And, you know, it looks like your head's going to get chopped off. No, you're going to blow up. And so it allowed the characters to always stay one step ahead. Which I always thought was really smart, because it's like a slasher if you knew who he was going to kill next and therefore you chose not to go in the garage. But that was the wrong choice in itself.
And it's all the things that could actually happen to you on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the gymnastic thing,
I can still feel it.
Not that would happen to me, because I wouldn't be doing them. But I remember when that one happened, I was just like, oh,
I would pay money to watch
from
you
five,
do that.
From 5 all 5.
But when I had Craig come into my class and talk about it, I had so many questions about how they come up with the how people are going to die in the Rube Goldberg that goes into it, because I've had those conversations where, like, and shit happens day to day where you're like, oh, almost died. Like small things like, you know, fork in the garbage disposal or things like that. Where it's like, shit, that could have gone really horribly wrong. So how have you guys, without revealing what they are, because I know that's like one of the biggest things with the movie, but how have the conversations gone to kind of come up with the Rube Goldberg and, you know, the interesting ways to off people?
Well, this was the nice thing about this particular process, was coming up with a why that everybody could defend. Why tell this story? Mm-hmm. Like, not trespass into seeing it as a grab of any kind, but really to be in line with the experience of when you go to see a big screen movie and the first trailer comes up and you don't know anything about it, you're kind of that privileged first view, and we trick you into getting into it, getting scared, and then when the title comes up, no way! Mm-hmm. Kind of like the first time we heard the Joker's voice in The Dark Knight. Mm-hmm. You've changed things. Like, that's the feeling we want.
Cool.
That was a nice appetizer.
Yeah. Good sex.
Can we talk a little bit about scary stories to tell in the dark? And I feel like, you know, talking more about contemporary stuff because, and this is just my, you guys were, I think the very first interview I ever conducted as a print journalist, I think it was like,
really?
Yeah, because it was Creative Screenwriting Magazine. You guys had just one project, Greenlight, for Feast.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I remember they hired me to do like a little sidebar, and they were like, get the horror guy to do a sidebar on these two kids that want to make a horror movie. But I feel like you guys are pretty like exhaustive in terms of everybody knows who you guys are. You've made your mark on the genre, and I feel like everybody knows what to expect from a Patrick and Marcus joint. So Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark feels like a little bit of a departure in terms of the kind of madcap crazy shit you guys have worked on. Mm-hmm. Tonally, I think, you know. So I want to just kind of hear about your involvement, how you guys got on board, how much has bled into the final product.
Except that dude at the end, he's crazy. Like the guy comes down the chimney thing and he attacks. I thought that was like a wild. Man.
Yeah, I want to ask about creature. That. I'm intrigued like what parts you kind of siphon from the stories because those were like Bibles growing up for me versus, you know, some of the newer inclusions. But we'll start with Ryan.
So. No. I'm just really curious because I know you guys were part of that process really mm-hmm. early on mm-hmm. in development. So I just want to hear how, you know, take us through the stages of it.
Well, how it started was my mom was a librarian at elementary school, and she mentioned to me at some point was that, you know, the most checked out books are Harry Potter, but then more than that is the book series, Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. And so that started us to, oh, yeah, those. And then, you know, we ordered them all and just reacquainted ourselves with them because it's really the artwork of Stephen Cabell, right?
Yeah.
That's, I mean, the stories are good stories, but, you know, without the, it's the artwork that really takes it to the next level. And so we, like, oh yeah, let's get this, let's try to option this. And then called, I can't remember who had it, but I guess it was the estate, but they had already given it to, this other group. And so it was, Sean Daniel. Mm-hmm. And so we got in contact with them and they had just gotten it and they didn't know what to do with it. And so we just went in and pitched our take. And that was, you know, using the book as the MacGuffin, right? And it you know, they open it and then stuff comes out and then they have to get the book back and put it back. And so that was the framing device that we pitched on. And I mean, keep in mind, we pitched that.
Yeah.
This is a while ago. I mean, it was
over, closing in on 7 years.
Hmm. What years are we in now?
2019. I think it's 2030. It's the Blade Runner year. I know that.
Instagram told me so.
Yeah. So it was it like 2012 when we sold it?
I think so. I just know it was like right before someone said, "So have you heard of Goosebumps?" We're like,
"No,
what?"
We pitched it everywhere. Yeah. Like we pitched it as a movie, and then everyone said no. And then I went to on a like a vacation, and then we came back, and we pitched it as animated, uh-huh. and everyone said no. And then we went in – this is funny, actually. We went into CBS Films, and it was Mark Ross and Alex Geno and really cool guys.
Yeah.
And we pitched to them, and they just, like, flipped from, you know, the first second. And then I remember how excited we were. Like, oh, my God, you guys going out with this pitch right now? And we're like, yeah. You better move fast. Yeah. And there were still places we were going to. But – and then we had some other interest, that's how I got set up there. So then we did several drafts and I mean our tone ours was the same framing device, which is the book, the MacGuffin, and the small town,
right.
Halloween, group of kids, all that. Our kids were a little in our version a little younger mm-hmm. and a little bit more Goonies, I'd say,
okay.
like the vibe. And then
what about the time period? Because that was saying that
we didn't do that.
The Vietnam time.
It was set in the era the books came out.
Yeah.
Which would have been 80s. Like early 80s, early to mid 80s.
Yeah. Do you guys know when that change happened in the development?
It was Guillermo's idea. Okay. So then, you know, the entire thing was John August came on after us and he did a version. And then the Hagmans, they wanted, CBS Films wanted something, they recognized the books were, you know, very marketable and all that, but they wanted something bigger. They wanted like a director. And so, you know, everyone says, okay, who, you know, the big directors, it's Guillermo, right? And most people say, let's get him. And most people don't.
Yeah.
But he, you know, it was, he was approached by the president of CBS and he, you know, he had. I mean, he knows it, and he has the artwork in his house. So they just worked out that way, and then
didn't you guys do something on, was it Pacific Rim?
Yeah,
Pacific Rim. You have a little history with him.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I tell you,
we did the on-set rewrites for that.
Yeah.
How many Oscar-winning directors can talk about the polish of a craft and all these genres with equal passion as they do Puppet Master 4.
Yeah.
This guy's a special human. Yeah.
so then he went to he wanted to put it in the 60, and only a guy like him can come in and say, I want to put this in the 60s, right? We come in and they'd be like, not happy. It's present day. But he says, no. And they're like, okay, well, fine. And so, it's good having to have, especially in the horror genre, it's great having heavyweight like that who just has his mind.
Was that for, because I did see, I know when it first came out, there were people, comparing the people disappearing to people who were disappearing in the war. Yeah. And Nixon. Mm-hmm. Was that his idea, or was it because he grew up in that time period? Do you recall?
I mean, I don't know which it was connected to. Mm. That was something he wanted from very early on.
Okay.
He just, and you look at a lot of his movies, like, they just,
50s or early,
sometimes
60s,
it has a more cinematic value to it. Uh-huh. And so, and then you solve the cell phone problem. And
that's true.
Certain things like that. And so, So then the Hagmans came on and they did work, and then it just, went to production, and there you go.
I appreciated how their vision and their take on the entire thing separated it from the pack that, let's say they did commit to something in the 80s, then we would have been with It, and we would have
been with Stranger Things.
And it was like, doggone it, we didn't. Yeah. Wouldn't have had a chance to hit as we intended back in 2011, 2012.
Right.
Whereas that touch and those influences of the 60s and like a country being torn apart from within became pretty timely.
Yeah.
And became quite personal. And I liked the division and fear amongst the kids was a nice catalyst for the horror that would come.
Mm. Yeah, and we'll think this is 2012, 2013 when we were writing it the first time, and we had kids, time period, and then these, inexpensive, and that just was, you couldn't walk into a room and say that at that point. Mm-hmm. Now, sure, but now it's already been done, so.
The coolest thing was I got to take my mom and sister as dates to that premiere, and Guillermo del Toro said our names.
Yeah.
And that was, that's it. So then Patrick was there with his children, and
that's awesome.
The mom who had the librarian background to say, hey, son, what do you think of this? Pretty cool life moment.
And it's funny because, we want, in terms of the tone and all our intention was to do something younger that, like, our kid, my kids could go see. Mm-hmm. And so an 11-year-old and a 12-year-old went to go see it. And this will lead to our next example of poor parenting, when I thought they could handle that. So certainly they could handle it too. which I don't want to, get too far ahead of ourselves, but I realized as the credits were starting, this might be a little too intense.
Oh my God.
Well, the 12-year-old scene is
the 12-year-old is fine, because the 12-year-old had seen the first one. He reads Stephen King, so he knew was like, oh, that's scary. It's like trying to be cool. But like the 11-year-old, I could tell, girl, she was just like, as soon as like the laughter, I could tell she was like, pretty aggressive. It's pretty revved up, and it just gets crazier and crazier and crazier, and
it's a lot uglier than the first one.
Yeah, she needs to leave. So years from now, when she's doing Shockwaves and it's 57th year, and you're like,
old man Turek realized.
Tell us long, about your first much, scare. Yeah.
Much longer so, beard. He's like, she'll tell the story of when her dad took her to when she was 11.
When I talk about your tone, it's just because we, I think so many horror fans know you guys for, just kind of, the excessive violence and madcap bloodshed from the Collector films and Piranha and all that fun stuff. So, by the way, it was really fun, and we were talking a little offline. Where I was staying in Wilmington throughout the Halloween Kills process was just around a corner from a water park. And I was like, oh, there's a cool water park here. Maybe when my kid comes into town, we got to go. I ran into a crew member, and he was like, That's where they filmed Piranha.
They filmed which one, that the original?
The double D.
3DD? I love 3DD.
Yeah,
well,
he's like, they filmed Piranha.
I have it in 3D.
And I said, oh, yeah, how'd you get those extras? And he's like, we went to the strip club.
Yeah. I'm gonna. Yeah.
I was like, "Wow,
back.
Okay."
I'm gonna leave the strip club, and I'm gonna take us back to Scary Stories really quick because I did want to ask the question that I mentioned at the beginning. How did you guys decide what to kind of take from the original books, things like Harold and the giant pimple, spider pimple, and then the new ones to put in, and even like you used
Spider-Man.
You used, it's not Oh Susanna, the one with the roommate with the flat face. Like, you used her, but it was completely different.
The pale lady.
Mm-hmm. Completely different. And then the jangly man is like a completely new invention, kind of based off Aaron Kelly, I'm guessing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Falling from the chimney. Yep. So how did you decide what to take and what to keep and which ones you were going to target?
Well, that's kind of where the two versions did Helix is we took some of the similar stories but implemented them in a different way. So it was neat to see how the same people, shared the same access to the same book and came up with two completely different ways of having them. So like the one thing I'd say that would be completely different from another universe is Patrick came up with a cool way to bring in the clown. From the cover of the book that's adorned on his arm.
Who is not actually in a story.
No, he's not in a story, but that corncob pipe, that look, we wanted to put our hat on that, and he had this bit where the kids at some point are running, and it was just that little goose that would be in there, and you just hear this warped voice, I didn't party without a clown. And then you see this thing, wha-bam, and come at him with a sledge. You'd be like, oh, okay. It was fun.
We used more from the book.
Which ones did you guys use, if I can ask?
I mean, like...
Same of the spider.
There was some that everyone recognizes being the most popular. Harold was a big
Harold's
one.
Harold's the big one, yeah.
And the red spot was a big one. Mm-hmm. The pale lady is a big one.
That one doesn't necessarily have much of a plot, but the graphic that goes along with it is remarkable.
Great. I mean, all that stuff is Guillermo, where like she's just there and then she just envelops the guy.
Yeah, I just love that.
Good stuff. We used like, I'm trying to think.
There were a number of illustrations.
The hearse that was driving around.
Oh, wow.
Imagine the kids are hiding in a graveyard behind the decayed woman gets out, who is also a seminal image from the covers.
The haunted house.
Yes,
story.
And she just wants someone to hold her hand and walk her home. Things like that.
Nice.
Where that's how it would tie in. It would Helix with someone else's story point. And then the hearse would go by laughing and chuckling, like, don't go in the green hearse. And it was fun. And our original character was an orchestrator of this, the Howling Man.
But that's from the cover. Yep. The one cover, it's the guy, and he's like, looks like he's
with
screaming.
With the hat on, and he's screaming,
So he was our central, our main villain. He was the main villain, and he was named the Howling Man. And so he was the one who would was like orchestrating it all.
Nice.
That's awesome.
So, yeah. But, it was but the decision when they came in was to just strip it down to more, just three specific ones and just lean into those.
Were there any stories that you guys really wanted to include that you couldn't, like, oh my gosh, this would just be too crazy? Like the baseball winner. I always love the one, the mother with the wooden tail.
The one I thought, like, oh, it'd be nice to reference the big toe, but how? And then we saw the movie, that's a brilliant way to do it.
That was my favorite story out of all of them. That was such a smart way to do it.
The ones that finally made it were probably the most popular, I think, right? Harold, Toe, Red Spot.
I wanted to do the Wendigo, but...
The Wendigo one, that's where they drag him?
Yes, following these precise footsteps, and then they just smear, 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 and the guy's gone.
I always liked that one because it's an untraditional Wendigo myth to begin with, the idea of the dragging and the fire and everything. Yep. So, yeah, it's a trip.
And the, pronunciation be darned, me tie Doty Walker.
Me tie Doty Walker. But I was so glad that they mixed it in there, that it made it in, because that was another one that I was like... I was curious how they would do it. So.
Dude, they pitchforked a kid. I thought, that's a remarkable level of violence they got away with. Wow. Yeah. I mean, and once again, please see Dr. Sleep, everybody. See
yes.
Dr.
Sleep.
Yeah. Including our co-host here.
Yes.
We just came up with our day. We're going Monday. Okay. Monday. Right. We are going to
final
see
answer,
it.
Final answer.
Yeah.
Oh, man. You guys brought up Pacific Rim, mm-hmm. and I think that, you know, for our listeners who want to get into the industry and such, I think they'd be find it interesting that you, when you said you were, like, on set, the mm-hmm. writers. Can you explain what that process is and what you do?
Well, I can tell an anecdote. Like, I was finishing inserts on the Collector sequel, and then Patrick boarded a plane about 12 hours prior, landed, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it was like, here's the first 15 pages. Rewrite these, and we'll see if you stay longer than 24 hours.
Well, wow, that's a threat. How did you even go from there?
Well, it was Canadian Thanksgiving, mm-hmm. so no one was in the office.
Right. So October.
Is that when it is?
Yeah.
Okay.
I just left Vancouver a couple weeks ago, and it was during Canadian Thanksgiving.
And so we were sent the script. We were working with Mary Parent and mm-hmm. Cale Boyder, like on something else, and they sent us Cale sent us a script on like a Friday, and was like, hey, you know, can you guys help with this? Blah blah blah. And they sent it, and you know, without reading, you're like, sure, no problem. What's this thing? And mm-hmm. then you read it, and they were going into production, so they needed some people. And there's a lot of people before us that worked on that and did a lot of really good stuff. And so Guillermo just needed some stuff to be implemented, and he's trying to direct this $200 million movie, so he just needed, you know, me and Marcus to be on the side, and he'll tell us ideas, and we'll put it in the script and stuff like that. And so. Yeah, I boarded the plane. I think it was Friday or Saturday. I think it was Saturday.
Might have made it on a
or maybe Sunday. So yes. Anyway, yeah. So, but when we got there, it was no one was in the office. It was a Monday, and I went in, and I was with Mary the night before, and we just talked about like some stuff it needed. And up front was I think there was that we wanted to add that scene with the brothers because there wasn't the two brothers. You know, they had before. One dies.
Yes.
There was no scene there. They just kind of died. And well, you know, like maybe we should see him just once to get that, see that they like each other.
Yeah.
So I think I said that. Yeah. And then Guillermo was like, go write that. And so I literally, so I was like, oh, okay. And I had to go out and there was no one. There was me at a desk and I just put my headset on and wrote that scene.
Yeah.
And gave it to him, and he goes, okay, you can stay.
I mean, I had no idea. Like,
and then Marcus gets out. You know, Marcus, he's editing. Yep. Like, and I think you were actually shooting.
I was shooting pickups for all these squibs, so I had fake blood on my shoes.
In, like, Apple Valley, right?
Yes.
With, up in Apple Valley around here.
And the elevator doors opened, and there was Mr. Del Toro, and he said, let me help you with your bag. Yeah. And walked us in. I mean, it was...
That's great.
It was unbelievable. It was well, okay.
Just magic.
So they were... So, we were up at Pinewood in Toronto, and there's like, I want to say like 20 stages, and Pacific Rim was on 19 of them. Mm-hmm. And then a little movie called Mama was on the one stage.
Yeah.
So like Jessica Chastain was there, and then Andy.
Mama. Because when I was a journalist, we did a set visit for Mama. And then we were like, what's going on over there? Yeah. And Guillermo walks us by and he goes, oh, that's just some fun robots. And we just saw the side of a Jaeger. Like, and we're like, what?
Like a big foot.
That's the set visit we also want to do.
Wow.
But it was cool. But then how about this? So that it was the extreme of, you know, it had about a $200 million movie, but still the same 50-cent application of enthusiasm is applied where you have all the stars, you have all the executives, you have the toy company, everything watching, and it still started with him – showing a 30-second clip of what this could be. And in this case, it was a very expensive ILM test, but it was a WWF robot giving it all to a creature.
Right.
And all of a sudden, didn't matter how jaded or experienced or jet-lagged anybody was, that woke up the childhood in every single person. And then you begin, and page one is boom.
Yeah.
And everyone saw the same movie.
That
was really cool.
Mm. That's awesome.
Wow.
Well, I want to talk quickly about Pilgrim.
Same
your
scale.
Entry in,
yeah. 200 million?
Yeah. Right.
Where was the set visit on that?
Giant shooting schedule, lots of effects.
Yes.
But, you know, these movies drop every the first Friday every month. And it was also the It's the second Thanksgiving themed one that our TV team has done. The first one being Flesh and Blood, Patrick Lussier's kind of cat and mouse father daughter thriller.
Yeah, that's right.
That was set around Thanksgiving, but this one you guys are leaning full on
full Thanksgiving,
absolutely. Full Thanksgiving, yes. And it's pretty fucked up.
Yeah. Thank you.
I remember Noah talking to me about it, and I was like, "Wait a minute, your family did what now?" Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Let's tell the audience what it's about.
So it's about you guys could actually we'll say
based on a true story.
Yes.
And it was Noah and his siblings and his mom and in the town he lived in, small town, I think back east, they host like a whole Thanksgiving thing. And so part of it, these actors come in and they're doing a reenactment of Thanksgiving, and the community will – each family will host some of the actors in their home. And Noah's family had this guy, this pilgrim guy, and the entire time he was there, he never broke character. And so – and like never – just a real name. And so that was the beginning of it. And so you can see the horror version of that. And so in our story, it's like family and with kids, and they're having problems. So the mom, who is the stepmom, thinks it would be a good idea to do this thing, and she brings in this acting troupe, and it starts with all the best intentions, and then the gets more intense and more intense.
They're very method, this troupe.
They take out the electricity.
Weird. It's such a weird concept.
Such a fucking slow burn becomes a blaze.
Cucking chair is involved. Yeah.
And you bring in Kerr Smith to play a dad.
I love that, actually.
I know.
Well, it was nice to hear him, talk about that. What a nice fellow. And then plus we did a little ghostwriting on My Bloody Valentine. So it was like,
oh wow.
Time and time again, we've come, close to the worlds of Kerr Smith. And now it's like, Kerr Smith, how's it going?
Yeah.
It was really cool.
Yeah. No, that was great. How far? This is like asking my company these questions. But how far were you willing to go? I mean, obviously, there's some pretty gnarly stuff in here. Were you ever asked to tone it back at all?
Yes. Asked to. Yes.
These
absolutely.
Are the guys that brought us Feast 2 and 3.
Yeah.
I'm saying.
They're snappy.
That's as far as
or shoot alts for a few moments just in case.
Really? Is this Hulu that is doing this? Like, they want it to be more accessible for younger audiences?
I think it was to just not get us deported. I mean, like, really?
You guys were pushing it that crazy.
Churning butter, thing they use, a churn butter.
There was a worse version of that scene that got pulled back a little bit. But our philosophy was that, like, if you're going to do this amongst all these other things that are out there with all the noise, mm-hmm. it's going to need to break through in some sense. So, like, if it's going to be Thanksgiving, let's give everything that you expect from Thanksgiving. Yeah. And there was inspiration from Eli Roth's, uh-huh. Thanksgiving, which, that was something that was in our mind when we were doing this. And so we just like, let's go anywhere you can mm-hmm. push, let's push. And so
if we've seen XYZ, what is our pie symbol that we can add on to the end of that?
And there's a few bits that we've been trying to get into movies for the past, 14 years that finally got in.
And then what really sold it was you have the main actor, Peter Giles, who plays our pilgrim. He's like a modern-day Vincent Price.
He's so good. He
approaches it with such sincerity and, like, man, you couldn't aim a camera at him. He was always – and not capture something special. And you knew he can commit it. And then so Elise Levesque picked up on that, and then you have these two wonderful opponents. And Rainn Edwards, it was her first lead role, and she's just a centrifugal force to all the drama. It was really cool.
Right.
Didn't know how funny Courtney Engler was until she hang out with her for a few days, and she's great. And then Kerr picked it up and could keep up with the pace. And little Antonio, who had never seen himself on a big screen until our premiere of that movie.
Aww.
And that was really cool.
I sat next to him.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, he was the only kid there. Because, having already exposed my children to inappropriate cinema I thought, maybe I should bring him. And then I thought, this might be a little bit too intense for them as well. And then there's this little kid there. So, yeah, he had a good time. But, Peter was – it was interesting because, we saw – he read for it. And, the second you saw it, you're like, that guy is
there.
And people say that, we just knew. But it was like – you saw his reading, and without any kind of direction, was just completely spot on.
Yeah.
And he just went for it. And like Marcus was said, when one of the actors shows up and is so committed, it just brings everybody else to life. Yep. And so, you know, and you can see the playfulness and like the filmmaking that Marcus put together and like the animated stuff up front and all that. Like just to, you know, try to make it a special little thing.
I'm really curious. What was the cartoon that's playing through the opening credits? What is that?
That's from the opening credits were the first things edited. And that was edited before we shot, throughout shooting, and right up until the last second, looking for educational films, looking for the benchmarks that we could find. And so it was going through Shutterstock, going through things like what can we possibly afford to depict the innocence and the marketing of Thanksgiving from our yesteryear, and then pervert it. So it was a very fancy Google hunt that led to that. And really the one educational film that was surprisingly it had a communist symbol on it and everything at the beginning. I was like, this is my house. It deserves a coat of paint, but it's mine. You know? You will stay in the kitchen. It was like really sinister, but delivered to be like, this is the mantra for the home and the family unit. And like, okay, I think we're on to something here.
Wow. Wow. shifting gears, you know, we've had screenwriters on before. We had Gary Dauberman on one time.
Yes.
But what is – so for you guys, what is that – there's always – you know, there's always secret sauce to every writer in terms of how to keep going. But what kind of advice do you guys have for those fledgling screenwriters that are out there? Because again, I mean, like to put things into context, the very first thing we talked about was Feast, and that was like 2002, 2003.
First draft started on that script started to be written Halloween weekend 1999.
Jesus,
wow.
Yeah. And then, and then 2004, I believe it was shot.
Yeah,
came out in 2005.
Yeah. And here we are 20 years later
from that time. Still alive.
You know,
bless you.
Still alive. Thanks. But I mean, what does it keep it fresh for you guys? I mean, obviously your energy. I mean, Marcus is known for his energy in this town, everybody.
thank you very much.
You're amazing.
Well, thank you.
But what is it? What is it? What advice can you impart?
I would borrow Chris Cargill, a.k.a. the Massive Worm of Ain't It Cool News. He has the best Twitter feed. And every day it's just keep writing. And he says, I'll do 3 pages a day. I have to do 3 pages a day. And that helps. Just keep going. Now, that may be different for somebody. For me, it might be jotting down a note or trying to catch up on 3 different movies. But just to keep exposing and staying excited in that way. And then trying to find the intimate conversation with an honest voice inside yourself. Like, what do I want to see? Why? If it's just shock value, eh. But what's really scary right now? Like, what scares Patrick is different now because he's a father of three. So there's different fears out there. It's fear of losing things versus fear of acquiring things. Fear of instantly becoming irrelevant because your voice is muted now. It's different. Someone comes up with something scarier. But I think it's constantly hitting the Flintstone and staying sharp.
Well, you know, having awareness of the genre, reading stuff, watching stuff, seeing just, you know – Anytime we get involved with something, we will immerse ourselves in whatever that is, right? Like in any subgenre it's in. Because, like, for example, like a werewolf thing. You see, okay, what worked, what hasn't worked, what are the sort of analogies that have been done before and metaphors and all that. And then, okay, what haven't we seen? Or what were some great ideas that were presented but maybe not executed as well as they could have been? And so how can we do that?
Yeah.
You know, so.
So Final Destination with the werewolf.
Oh, yes.
Is the reveal that you
happening.
Get one time.
That's it.
Wow. That
you
would,
heard
I kind of want
here.
To see that now. It was a werewolf all along. He just didn't want to get involved.
Invisible werewolf. Werewolf, guys. Dang. You're welcome.
That's no Predator werewolf. Purge, but it's pretty good.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Predator Purge?
That's why occasionally you see his shadow.
Predator Purge.
Occasionally.
He's like, let's do this. Yeah, let's
the day he comes down.
And then I was like, well, that was effed up. But
you
get whatever.
Grillo versus Predator. I mean, I'm into that.
Yeah, and he's like, and
Grillo versus a werewolf.
Yeah, like, oh, yeah, Grillo as the invisible werewolf. Or, boom.
Predator, Purge, did you say with werewolf, Final Destination,
like,
guys.
You can almost see the ending of that when they're about to, and then the sun comes up and they're just like, well,
yeah,
until next year, bro.
Because he's invisible.
Yeah.
Let's take it further. Grillo Metal Beast remake?
Oh, okay. Ooh. Well, that's very you, so.
Man, wow. Is that on the docket for 2020? Blumhouse? Yeah. Let's see.
That's an A+ idea.
You know Blumhouse is all about remaking some Metal Beast.
Yeah, PG-13 Metal Beast. Hey-o.
A call out to yourself. That was good.
What have you guys kind of been watching lately yourselves? Like, again, you say you get immersed when you're working on something, but like, what excites and like impresses you?
Boy, I was inspired watching the Invisible Man trailer.
Right?
Because.
Yeah. Oh, my God, yeah.
Yeah, it was what a.
But that's one of those ones you're like, God damn it. Like, why didn't I think
that? That's all I could think the whole time is like, this is so simple yet so smart. Because that's what everybody's fear was like, that it would be this kind of the same kind of structure as the earlier one. And then watching it and just being like, oh, they just said fuck that and did something completely different. Yes. That is horrifying in the current age.
Scary,
so smart.
A wonderful, scary movie anchored in the performance we see. Like, oh, how cool is that?
Yeah.
So that was inspiring. And then last night I watched, and correct, I might have the title wrong, The Most Beautiful Island?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
I finally saw that.
Fessenden's company put that one out with Russian, is she Russian immigrant? She's from maybe Ukraine or somewhere
like that. And I just thought, like, well, isn't that inspiring? Because it wasn't. Yeah. It's a horror movie.
Yeah.
Well, it's a thriller.
It's a horror of being disconnected and not knowing how to make money in a town. And then it leads to a sequence. It's almost like a prolonged sequence, but the sequence becomes so surprising.
And how that's the biggest workout my mind has had in imagining the worst case scenario behind that door.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And then it still surprised me what's behind the door. Like, what a hat trick. Any movie that does that, like, you'll hear a scream. What could that possibly be? And, oh, you do all the heavy lifting until they have that one up on you.
And it's the really actress is the writer-director.
Yes.
So she's, she's all, and pretty, it's a remarkable little movie.
Yeah, I thought it was just tremendous. And you know, when it ends, there's like, you're just haunted with it. And so I watched that right after Dr. Sleep, which again, go see Dr. Sleep, which was a nice, it was just nice proof that big budget horror can still be affecting and still be savage and still have a lyrical quality to it as well. Like, I loved it. I cried.
Mm, me too.
It's an emotional movie. Like, wow.
You cried three times, didn't you say?
Yeah.
Yeah, there are three instances, yes. For sure.
Gosh.
I would have cried.
We should take you back.
We're going fucking Monday, Kane.
There you go. There you go.
Melton, what are you exposing your children to? What awful scary movies?
You know, it is – I am exposed to probably more like gateway horror stuff than Marcus, you know, based on what's streaming and all of that sort of stuff. So, I mean, like, I really like the Are You Afraid of the Dark? Are You Afraid of the Dark? Are You Afraid of the Dark?
Are You Afraid of – that's what I was talking about,
Yeah, I mean, that was just like
perfect for the kids.
Yeah, great. Mm-hmm. Like, but I'm telling you, I have one kid's just turned 13 and one's 11, and they're getting pretty snooty about their horror. Mm. They're like, I mean, even like Halloween.
Our Halloween or John's?
Your Halloween.
Oh,
my 13-year-old was like, well, it's not like, scary, but like, I'm like, oh, okay.
Oh, really?
I'm pulling Jane, Silent Bob. I'm like, give me your address. I'm gonna come back.
Oh, you want to see scary?
Hey, kids.
No, but I was like, no, but like, I mean, I'm watching you watch it, and you're looking away at certain moments, and you're flinching at certain moments, and he's like, yeah, which, it's like, it's Michael Myers, like he's like starting dissect it. Like,
what kind of horror do you think would? Because I always find that interesting. What would scare someone? So a 13-year-old's getting savvy. Like, what do you think from the canon? If you pulled, would it be something like as committed as and kind of like an Exorcist, or would it be something more like an It Follows? Because there's this, maybe the sexuality would be a little beyond them because they're only 13.
Well, we heard It Too did it.
Yeah,
yep.
But not with the 13-year-old, right? That didn't scare the.
He didn't. He wasn't scared of the.
Yeah.
Too, because I think he'd read the books and he already sort of knew a lot what was going to happen, and there's visual tricks that right that the 11-year-old was not. It's like, oh, this scene's over, it's like score, and it's like really got you.
Yeah.
Like, I would not expose the 11-year-old to Halloween because the sort of realism of it, I think, would be too much for her. The first one, the 13-year-old, I showed him, some of these moments he reflect back of like, I showed him, he saw the original Halloween a long time ago, and he was just like, meh. And there's certain things like that a lot of the kids don't have the patience for, and they don't find it all that as unnerving as I did when I – that was the one that when I saw it at an inappropriate age, and it was just too much. I mean, I saw – people probably know this from other things, but I saw Poltergeist in the theater at 7.
Wow.
Like, that's too much. And the moment in like in that movie where it ends, this house is clean, they're like, oh, thank God, I've made it. And then the movie keeps going, and you're going, well, why are we still here? And then
you failed, like, I want
you to screen, it might be too because of the sexuality, but Autopsy of Jane Doe for the 13-year-old.
Oh.
I feel like that one could creep the hell out of them.
We showed that.
But there's a naked woman a lot, so you might have to, yeah, that's up to you. But
yeah, Elric and I showed that in a class last week.
But I just think that one has the right kind of creep and jump scares to where it might get them. Yeah, if you're trying to show him something that...
Well, does have a very naked woman the entire movie. She's getting an autopsy. I mean, it's not sexual.
Don't worry, she's dead.
She's getting an autopsy.
Classic.
But she is laying there naked.
But she is beautiful.
The only concern, though, having gone through this as being exposed a thing, all of you also exposed at a young... It's not so much in the moment is it scary, right? It's night.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
When you're alone, and I'm like... Because I thought, like, with Halloween, I thought, okay, you're acting like you're not scared now, but then tonight, when the clock in the house... and it's dark, and you start seeing things, and so, you know...
That's how I felt when I saw the 88 Blob. Because I was like, oh, this is...
Yeah.
Creatures and cool stuff. Yeah. And then I went to bed that night and I was like, the blob is outside my fucking window.
I know.
That
still happens with stuff though. Like things that you're just not, and then just like, I'm trying to think what it was. I mean, not an easy example was somebody like The Strangers where you see it and you're like, oh, that's crazy and it's really good. And then you're at home.
Yeah.
I think what it is, my light, you know, my front light being on. Remember, it's just your light. You're home, right?
Yeah.
And so I think of every. I still think about that when I turn on and off the light at night.
Or like, if you live in Silver Lake, The Invitation. That's just scary living in Silver Lake. You know,
I have a hipster house. Oh, God,
terrifying.
No, I was telling them before the show started when he was talking about his kids in it too about how my dad took me to see heavy metal at like a stupid young age. I was probably 5 when we went to see that in the theater.
5
I was probably like. Whoa.
I mean, we would see when we would go to the Saw, we go to, you know, Saw openings. It was, I mean, we would see babies there.
Yes.
Yeah, like, I guarantee.
Like 4-year-old, 3-year-old, 4-year-olds at like the 10:30.
I do not think I had started school yet when he took me
but
to see
heavy
metal.
They can't take it in. A baby's fine.
No, but like even still.
Yeah, a baby's fine.
It was cerebral stuff in it that I had to sit here and go, now what was that? Wait, why did the skull melt? And it wasn't like I believed any of it was real, but it definitely like fucked me up. And then I ended up loving horror and metal, so go dad. But yeah. Now, have your kids seen House with the Clock in Its Walls yet? That was one that my kids just loved. And it's directed by...
Eli Roth?
Yeah. Or is that a little too young for them?
No, they've seen it, but I don't think it's scary.
My kids loved it for some reason, which is actually when I was on... Did your kids see this one, Eric?
Not yet.
Yeah, my kids really...
I haven't seen it.
They're too busy watching fucking Autopsy of Jane Doe.
Yeah, we're watching
Child Protective Services listening to this episode.
Mine are the biggest chicken shit. They're not watching any of this. Just started Scooby-Doo.
After I saw House with Clock in Its Walls, I was on Doug Loves Movies podcast with Eli, and I asked him, I was like, is the opening shot a direct like parody of Texas Chainsaw Massacre? Because it's set up the way that it is, and one of the shots, and he was like, you were the only fucking person who would have gotten that. But yeah, it is. Like, it's definitely pulling from horror knowledge. And it's really well done.
The 8-year-old is scared by like the Scooby-Doo, the you know the hardened ones, the you know the 13, he's good, but yeah, but because they do watch a lot of stuff, you know, because there's a lot of stuff available, and you know, like I mean, the thought process with the 11-year-old going to It too, you know, was I forgot that it was R. That's first of it, but it was Stranger Things, you know, and then that links to some other things, and then. It all seems to be the same in my brain, and then
you realize.
I mean, it's not like it was like, Hostel or something like that.
that might have been
save that for 14.
You know what I'm curious about is like you guys were so long embedded in the Saw world.
Mm-hmm.
How does it feel to know that there's a new one coming out from Bousman, who you guys worked with, that you had nothing to do with? Like you get to actually experience one as a fan.
It's exciting because every time. It seems like they're putting a really cool engine in the story and behind it, and they're taking their time with it. So, yeah, I'm excited to see another cool horror movie. Plus, like, who's Samuel L. Jackson in it? Yeah. Like, what's Chris Rock?
Chris Rock.
Well,
it's science.
Because what do we? I mean, we probably know as much as you. Mm-hmm. It's a Saw movie, but it's in kind of like I wouldn't say a parallel universe, but it is a. Whatever side little thingy, and it happened. I mean, I'm assuming John Kramer's
in it?
Is he? We don't know.
I don't know. I mean, do you know? I don't know.
I don't. I mean,
I'm guessing. I would.
I have no idea.
I love that those questions are...
doing conventions while they were shooting it. So
yeah, those questions keep me interested. I want to see it. Like, yeah, that's neat.
So
we'll see.
And that they're bringing it out in May. Hey.
Oh, right. It is in May.
Yeah.
Have you guys done a thing on it yet?
Yeah, I think that's the first time it's even come up. It's cool that Bowsman gets to come back to it.
It was supposed to come out in October, and then they moved it up.
Did they say what it's going to be called?
No, not yet.
Let's take a guess. Let's go around the table. Rob, what do you think it's going to be called?
Saw the Return? I don't know.
Elric?
I'm not even going there.
Come on.
I'll say something inappropriate and be canceled.
Becca?
Jigsaw
2
something.
All right.
Ryan's got a game. Ryan's
do you
got a
know?
Game.
You know?
No,
Ryan's
I don't.
You
I don't.
Do know. He knows everything.
He's okay, the puppet. I just wanted to say, I'm going to call it Saw Infinity.
My guess.
Saw, or Saw Traps.
My guess there is a.
Saw Traps. That's like more like an encyclopedia.
Right? Saw Traps.
Yeah.
Saw what,
what's your guess?
Well, it can't be Jigsaw, right?
Yeah.
Right. It can't just be. So probably Saw. Colon something, right?
I think that's
afterlife.
Reverse afterlife.
Saw afterlife.
Infinity. That.
Well, that's what I thought would have been great if they did that for 8, because then the 8 could be tilted on its side and look like an infinity.
Missed opportunity.
That is cool.
I'm gonna guess Saw Resurrection or Jigsaw Resurrection. Somehow it's gonna work in the word resurrection because that gets put in every franchise at least once.
Very Bob Weinstein.
Yeah.
Resurrection. See what I did?
Although they could be at a they could be at a point where they can just rebrand it Saw again. Like you can get away with two of those, right?
Colon
again. What about
Saw 2020?
Saw
2020. Saw 2020.
The Saw
2020 is not bad.
Saw Bloodwings. I'm doing it.
Bloodwings. You know, it was like, but really, I mean, Saw was Tim Palin, and he's no longer there.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, all that really crazy stuff was him, so I don't know.
Very curious. Yeah, all the nurses, went away.
The blood drive was named.
Saw, it's about traps.
Yeah.
There we go.
I just keep thinking with Amityville? Chris Rock, it's got to be something really
pulling out those
up, you know?
Random Amityville references and just dropping them on the table.
Saw, it's about traps. That's good, Becca.
Thank you.
Very good. Bowsman's listening. He's just like, fuck you guys.
I'm ready for the return.
Yeah, and then he's
going to
use it's about traps. Y'all wait.
Well, gentlemen, thanks for coming on.
Thank you guys.
Talking
so
all
much.
Things. Oh, but wait, you two.
Oh, wait, he has a sheet.
You two are like little.
He has something to read.
But wait. Because
a soliloquy?
We brought them in a little bit earlier, and they were at the end of this table, and they were like passing a piece of paper like little school kids.
They have a prepared statement.
I thought, you know, the fascinating.
Yeah, okay, sure. Well, there is an ongoing list we do have of just called People Who Fucked Me. And
we'll play some music under it while you
are
say
we
it.
Airing dirty laundry
we'll just close this out with some music and you guys just listing names.
There is one thing. This doesn't go under People Who Fuck Me. This is just, you know, just so we're all clear. You brought up the guys who did Haunt.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Right. Yeah. The guys who did they wrote Perfect and they wrote Quiet Place.
This, so we can establish there can really only be one writing team from Iowa.
I get it. Okay. I get it.
So,
but they must have donated more than we did because they made the montage at the campus we did.
Yeah, they're like verified.
They got blue check marks.
Yeah.
I was like, well, anyway. So I thought, like, what's fascinating about Shockwaves is you guys have amazing with it. Moving and shaking stories, and I had some questions for you.
Oh my god!
Oh god!
Yeah, here we go.
Oh god!
Is this all right?
I think we're ready.
And by all means, if it needs a think moment, I can hot potato it. Ryan Turek. Ryan, producing is problem solving. What is your most rewarding example of accessing and tackling a production challenge? What's your favorite memory on set?
Problem solving?
Yeah.
I mean, I like to think of every day a day of problem solving. But fuck, my favorites I can't talk about yet.
Okay.
Oh, I can't talk about
it. Oh, that's a bit of a...
No, it's not a miss, but like Halloween Kills brought up a lot of challenges, but there was one in particular that I think I did all right at. And
okay.
It'll be announced later down the road.
Sub question to that, in case that was the answer. Are horror budgets finally going up across the board?
Ooh, good question.
Our horror budget at Blumhouse?
Oh, just across the board. There used to be the 20-day schedule, and it's got to be under five guys.
Yep.
Well, it's 5-5 here. Five, okay. Yeah.
Hey, that's up.
Yeah, yeah. It's up from 3 when this is like 3.
Shows you how bad we are as the guests. This is really illustrating this point.
I'm trying to figure out what we're getting at. No, they're not going up. They're not going up. No. No, not at Blumhouse. Okay. No, but I mean elsewhere, yes.
Does Dr. Sleep help this?
Oh, jeez.
That's loaded. Jesus.
That's terrible.
That's a terrible thing to bring up.
I want to help Dr. Sleep. That movie's awesome.
Listen, Dr. Sleep. No, I truly believe that there are movies that warrant larger budgets than we can afford. I mean, I could truly believe it. Like, say, Nightmare on Elm Street. If Nightmare on Elm Street, Blue Sky, got all of the legal stuff got ironed out mm-hmm. and, you know, they all figured that out. I truly believe that Nightmare would need a larger budget.
What would your dream budget be for Ryan Turek's Friday the 13th?
Mm. Ooh, man. This runs well,
you need, yeah. You need yeah. snow. So you got the snow. Snow. So that's already snow. Expensive.
Believe it or not, I would do it without snow, guys.
No, the opening scene has to be snow. And then it thaws.
That's you.
It's because everybody's already put the snow pipe dream of Jason Voorhees in like a snowy crystal lake in their head.
Yeah.
We'll never be able to live up to those expectations. So let's just go back to
it's just the opening scene. Don't worry.
Although, if you could think that first shot, you open it, boom, and everyone goes, oh, snow. Yeah.
And then you cut to the black and then it's the kind of Christmas, and suddenly it's spring.
Yeah. That's it, exactly. You dump all the money into the snow, and then the rest is spring.
$4 million on snow. Okay.
I've been very vocal that Friday the 13th is one of my you know dream projects.
The bigger question is, will it ever be ironed out?
Yeah, that's maybe. The big question. Yeah.
Ever.
Maybe.
Curious, yeah.
Totally. Thank goodness Jason won't die. Yeah. Neither will the rights.
Yeah,
they got to come back
at some point.
Miss McKendry.
Yes, sir.
You have co-directed with David Even McKendry.
Yes. Yes.
On All the Creatures Were Stirring.
Yes.
What is the moment wherein collaboration saved the day, and how did that come about?
We have a really good system that we like on set where I am very actor focused and I mm-hmm. want to be on set. Like, I get frustrated when I get like relegated to Video Village. I don't want to have to sit there. And so I really enjoy being on set with actors. And Dave is much more of a visual person and he really wants to be looking at kind of the bigger picture on screen. And so that tends to be how we kind of divide and conquer it. And it works well in that regard. Because we were doing an anthology for that one, and because I was stupid pregnant for much of it, it worked out well because we definitely had moments where I would need to step off set repeatedly to go to the bathroom.
Okay.
And so that definitely helped. And then there were just in general, like it really worked well on that one. My subsequent ones have been just me by myself. And I still get frustrated when I have to go sit in Video Village for extended periods of time. Sure. I'm like, I need to be in the action. It's all happening over there and I want to see the acting. So what I do now is I always have the first AC set me up a monitor right next to wherever the focus puller is. So I can just stand there and I'll like, I'm watching here, guys. I'll go to Video Village later. I'll watch the dailies. But yeah, I still like to be in kind of the middle of everything.
Are the current film students excited about the movies that excited us?
Not necessarily.
Where does their attention span go?
YouTube. And YouTube.
So shorter, punchy.
Yeah. No, I can say point blank, YouTube. Like when I ask my students, what are they watching?
Mm-hmm.
Occasionally, I mean, like they're film students. They will still see one movie a week. They will still go see The Peanut Butter Falcon or whatever like the cool film of the week is.
Okay.
But when I ask, like, I always open all of my classes by asking who watched what this week. And it's always just how I open the conversation. And it's always just like, well, I watch this or this. And sometimes they'll say older movies. The majority of the stuff that they are watching is YouTube. And so even their shows that they're watching are television on YouTube. And the things like when they're talking about, oh, did you see what this guy did this week? Or have you seen this new episode? a lot of them are YouTube. And I feel so out of touch, so much so that I have had to go back and watch. It's how I found Dragula, by the way. I've had to go back and watch some of the YouTube shows that they keep recommending to me, because it feels honestly like an entire different media that I have not yet been a part of. And so I'm now catching up. So when my students recommend, and there's tons of horror shows on YouTube that I had never seen before. And so now when they're recommending all 5 minutes, but that is primarily where they are spending the bulk of their viewing time.
Wow, thank you for that.
No problem.
Which brings me to Elric.
I feel like Becca got easier questions.
I have to work with my husband.
He's about to ask me about Pornhub, so I'm getting ready here.
Was Kissy Kissy at all inspired
by
the great song by The Kills of the same
name? It wasn't, actually. I don't remember that name came from. I think it actually just came from...
What is Kissy Kissy?
Is that one of your features?
Kissy Kissy, yeah, it was a New Zealand film I made.
It's like a multi-character. Research these guys
This
did.
Is kind of weird. I think it just came from like almost a joke saying like situation was Kissy Kissy, kind of mocking mumblecore almost, because it was around that same time. Got so it's kind of in that vein. Yeah,
we're big fans of Savannah College of Art and Design. We've been lucky to collaborate with some folks from there. Is there an experience there that has helped you to this day? Is there something you're like, hey, I'm still...
Yes. Okay. There's a Czechoslovakian directing teacher who I was like, I remember first day they showed a Tarkovsky film and I was the only person still awake at the end of it. It was amazing. Like everyone was asleep. It was like just a beautiful image. But I'll never forget, there was somebody who shouldn't have been at that school, and they had just made a film that just, you're just like, why is this person even that film? You could tell they didn't have passion for film. And he just, it was the most brutally honest thing I've ever seen in my life. And he just goes, your film is like 2 pound shit in 1 pound bag. And my fucking jaw was on the ground, because he's a very respectful guy. But when I heard that, I was like, I wonder if he understands what he just said. And it broke her, but it also made her probably go, oh yeah, this isn't for me.
Oh,
and because it was so fucking honest. So I try to not say that to people when I teach, but I do try to get it across. But I do try to get across that same kind of honesty if I really think, because I don't want somebody to waste their money.
Yep.
You know, because it is a little heartbreaking to how much film schools can cost people. So you do want it to be a possible thing for them. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that stuck with me. But there's also a lot, you know, lots of stuff. That is a beautiful, because it's also in terms of horror, it did actually shape me, because we made it. It's meant to be the most haunted town in America, even more than New Orleans, and it's because so many bodies are buried all over the place. But we actually got taken in, speaking of con men, by a guy who does the main ghost tours. So we made our documentary for our school on the guy, and we fully believed everything he said until we made the documentary on him. And then we just saw, we saw the long con of it all, and it was fascinating to see that aside. So that was one of those things that stuck with me too. Yeah. So
I have a touchback question for you when I jump into Bobby G.
Okay.
You could curate a film night for an idol of yours, who would it be? And what would the films be? Right into Rob Galuzzo.
I'll come back.
With Icons of Fright.
Oh, man.
Throughout the year.
It's like a sideshow.
You have been exploring that great internetosphere and helping bridge the gap between those looking for the best fright and finding it and bringing awareness to it. So what is the best you've seen of social media and the internet doing this and helping bridge that gap to finding a right distribution deal? How is somebody on the other side of this broadcast wanting to know what you know? What's the best way for them to know it? I've got a movie. I want to get it out there. I want to get eyeballs on it.
We get asked that a lot.
That is a very, very difficult question.
Ryan Turek, who's the killer in your Friday the 13th?
Jason Voorhees?
Okay. Easy answer.
You've got easier questions than me.
I think I got the hardest question of all. Are you basically asking how do you make a dent out in social media nowadays?
Yeah, because like you're out there, and I think you and Ryan and Elric and Rebecca, you guys have all been a part of this. Ryan was the first person to visit our edit bay, and that was a printed word getting out there on the internet to let us know we were existing. And then it's just grown. And so with it growing, all right, how did I know the beautiful island? I wouldn't have seen that, but I read some article somewhere and I remember this picture and I remember saying, what's behind that door? And it culminated 3 years later in me seeing it last night.
Yeah.
Someone out there has something pretty awesome. They just need to get people to watch it. They need to get on this show. What's the best way?
Man, I really don't. The reason I don't know how to answer this is because things have evolved so much. Like, I couldn't start Icons of Fright now and make a blip. It really.
Okay.
Ryan and I come from a period of timing. I mean, honestly, even when I met him, like I, you know, people do email me randomly asking for advice and stuff. And if I have time and I have the answer at that moment, I will reply. Mm-hmm. If I don't, I'm just so overwhelmed that I don't know what to say. Whereas I texted Ryan, like, I didn't even know him. Just somebody – I was in town and somebody was like, hey, you two would get along. And I texted him. He's like, great. Why don't you come out tonight? And that was it. And all of a sudden – and I kind of feel like that was I don't know. I don't know what that version of that is today. I'm much older. I don't run the social media for Fangoria or any of that stuff because I just don't know how people make a difference there anymore.
Yeah. I feel like, social media is taking over for the websites. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I mean, like, you know, I mean, like the Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, especially. I just don't think that the websites that we had created as we know it, you know, Dread Central, Bloody Disgusting, Shock Till You Drop, CreatureCorner.com, you know, Icons of Fright. These, you're right. I mean, like they hit at just the right amount of time, like when people needed certain information.
Yes.
I mean, and there was no social media at the time. There were message boards. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, like Creature Corner message boards were famous. I mean, like people would go there and talk. You know, that's actually how I got in, was writing reviews about Vincent Price movies on Creature Corner's message boards. And somebody was – and, you know, Johnny Butane was like, hey, you want to write for the site? So that's now awesome. It's just all – it's all – everybody's got their own personal social media thing, and everybody can write long dissertations on underneath an Instagram post about what the movie they saw.
And if you think about it, like how do we even get our movie news now? Like I didn't know that the Invisible Man trailer dropped because I went to a specific site. Yeah. I logged into Twitter that morning and everybody was tweeting about it, and I was like, oh, okay, there we go.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And I wait, like Invisible Man, that deserved the biggest TV I could get to. I wanted to watch it there, but that gave me the heads up.
Yeah.
Fantasy Island was like, ba-bam, by the way, here
that
we are.
That trailer looks awesome.
Yes, it does.
Oh, I'm glad you guys dig it.
And thank you very much for the Halloween Kills on Halloween. That was a very clever, hey, we're shooting. But happy Halloween.
Universal Marketing.
That was
awesome.
Neat. Yes.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, like, I do think that websites still serve a purpose, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, like, what Brad and the company at Blade Disgusting, you know, they're breaking stuff. They're breaking news.
Yep.
But they all know that they have just a limited window before that information that they dropped hits social media, and it just becomes information download that goes out to social media to people that don't even care where it originated from. Mm-hmm. And that's why it was such an easy process for me when I left Shock Till You Drop to come here, beyond the, oh my God, I get to finally, you know, get into the business and be what I want to be. It was an easy departure because things were shifting at that point. Mm-hmm. So I was like, BuzzFeed had just gotten its hold into everybody.
Sure.
Information was needed to be crunchy and fun and poppy and come with GIFs and, you know, memes and all this shit. And I was like, fuck that. I'm not going to answer to a corporate entity that wants me to do best killers, but in meme form. And it's like, I'm not going to do that. That's just dumb. So, and that's why I'm glad Fangoria came back.
Yes.
Because that is where I feel like I can sit down anytime and get information, like well thought out, well written information about the genre.
Like
and
the OG. Yep.
I just wrote two articles for the website this week. So I'm excited that they're bringing back the website as well.
Yeah. How about when Martin Scorsese interviewed David Cronenberg for Fangoria?
Yeah.
I just read that. Yeah.
Come on. This is really great. So I'm glad that Fangoria gets to come back and earn that little plastic body bag that it comes in.
And like, that's something really I look forward to now, because I'm like, okay, so Ari Aster just interviewed Eggers. Who's Eggers going to interview next month in the next quarter? So I'm excited.
Wow. And how about that evening? Who's the idol? Jesus. What's the curation?
Jeez. I mean, I'd probably pick Clue Gulager.
Naturally.
Because he's a good audience member. Yeah. I might have to tweet this. This needs thought. Curation needs thought.
Oh,
so I promise within the day this airs on Friday, I will be – anyone can check our Twitter. I'll be writing to both of you.
Thank you.
How many movies? Like a triple feature?
I think a triple.
Okay.
And you can't accuse him of being in Night of the Lepus.
No, I won't do Clue. Clue's great, but I'll pick someone else. I'll pick someone from the past. You have my word.
Okay.
Can't curate on demand unless it's Predator.
I don't think we've ever been interviewed by a guest.
I know. It's super funny.
Well done for giving them something different.
Well, I love listening to the show, and I want to know, and I want people to know more about you guys, because you guys are in it. Like, Ryan, you just returned from a set of the biggest horror movie of the next October.
Wow.
You're teaching kids.
You have access to all these ears. You're with Fangoria. Like, Fangoria taught me how to spell Stephen King. And it's amazing that it's coming back and it's reaching new eyes and ears. So, yeah. Yay. Well, and then there's Patrick Melton. Stoic.
He listens.
He's somehow getting younger by the day.
I do. You guys were on the show very long ago.
Yeah, you were on Killer Pimpy
a very long time
ago. We got to look up which episode that was.
Yeah. I tried to the other day because I wasn't sure if we were on Shock. I didn't think so because we did it in North Hollywood, maybe?
Yeah, that was you guys were on for The Collector then. But The Collection.
The Collection, yeah.
Yeah, Collection.
They don't really exist.
Now with more Turek. That's what our show says. Now with more Turek.
Yeah. I think they're floating around YouTube at this point because they're not on iTunes anymore, the Killer POV episodes.
Oh, right.
So somebody must have put it on YouTube, I think.
One day it will all come back.
It will all be back eventually.
Well, guys.
Thank you guys.
Thank you so much
so
for coming
much.
On.
Thank
you very we
much.
Look forward to seeing what you guys do with Final Destination and
Watch Pilgrim.
Everything else. Yes,
Hulu.
Watch Pilgrim.
Watch
thank
Pilgrim.
You.
Gobble,
it's, Thanksgiving. It's Thanksgiving month, everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Happy Thanksgiving, guys. Well, we're not quite there yet.
It will be next year.
Becca's preemptively saying
I'm preemptively. I'm like, happy Thanksgiving. I'm happy. I'm thankful
happy
for
Halloween,
you jerk
everybody.
Asses.
Tune in next week when Ryan gets to talk about Berserker. That's all you need to know.
And Elric and I will have seen
we'll see
Dr.
About
Sleep.
That.
Well, we're also going to see that fancy nitrate print.
But that's not horror, really.
Bye.